Great Expectations. Chapter 1. My father's family name being Pirib, and my Christian name Philip, my infant tongue could make of both names nothing longer or more explicit than Pip. So, I called myself Pip, and came to be called Pip. I give Pirib as my father's family name, on the authority of his tombstone and my sister, Mrs. Jo Gargery, who married the blacksmith. As I never saw my father or my mother, and never saw any likeness of either of them, for their days were long before the days of photographs, my first fancies regarding what they were like were unreasonably derived from their tombstones. The shape of the letters on my father's gave me an odd idea that he was a square, stout, dark man, with curly black hair. From the character and turn of the inscription, also Georgiana wife of the above, I drew a childish conclusion that my mother was freckled and sickly. To five little stone lozenges, each about a foot and a half long, which were arranged in a neat row beside their grave, and were sacred to the memory of five little brothers of mine, who gave up trying to get a living, exceedingly early in the universal struggle, I am indebted for a belief I religiously entertained that they had all been born on their backs with their hands in their trousers pockets, and had never taken them out in this state of existence. Ours was the marsh country, down by the river, within, as the river wound, 20 miles of the sea. My first most vivid and broad impression of the identity of things seems to me to have been gained on a memorable raw afternoon towards evening. At such a time I found out for certain that this bleak place overgrown with nettles was the churchyard, and that Philip Pirib, late of this parish, and also Georgiana wife of the above, were dead and buried, and that Alexander, Bartholomew, Abraham, Tobias, and Roger, infant children of the aforesaid, were also dead and buried, and that the dark flat wilderness beyond the churchyard, intersected with dikes and mounds and gates, with scattered cattle feeding on it, was the marshes, and that the low leaden line beyond was the river, and that the distant savage lair from which the wind was rushing was the sea, and that the small bundle of shivers growing afraid of it all and beginning to cry, was Pip. "Hold your noise!" cried a terrible voice, as a man started up from among the graves at the side of the church porch. "Keep still, you little devil, or I'll cut your throat." A fearful man, all in coarse grey, with a great iron on his leg. A man with no hat, and with broken shoes, and with an old rag tied round his head. A man who had been soaked in water, and smothered in mud, and lamed by stones, and cut by flints, and stung by nettles, and torn by briars, who limped, and shivered, and glared, and growled, and whose teeth chattered in his head as he seized me by the chin. "Oh! Don't cut my throat, sir," I pleaded in terror. "Pray don't do it, sir." "Tell us your name," said the man. "Quick." "Pip, sir." "Once more," said the man, staring at me. "Give it mouth." "Pip. Pip, sir." "Show us where you live," said the man. "Pine out the place." I pointed to where our village lay, on the flat inshore among the alder trees and pollards, a mile or more from the church. The man, after looking at me for a moment, turned me upside down, and emptied my pockets. There was nothing in them but a piece of bread. When the church came to itself, for he was so sudden and strong that he made it go head over heels before me, and I saw the steeple under my feet, when the church came to itself, I say, I was seated on a high tombstone, trembling while he ate the bread ravenously. "You young dog," said the man, licking his lips, "what fat cheeks you ha got." I believe they were fat, though I was at that time undersized for my years, and not strong. "Darn me if I couldn't eat em," said the man, with a threatening shake of his head, "and if I ha'n't half a mind tot." I earnestly expressed my hope that he wouldn't, and held tighter to the tombstone on which he had put me, partly, to keep myself upon it, partly, to keep myself from crying. "Now looky here," said the man. "Where's your mother?"
"There, sir," said I.
He started, made a short run, and stopped and looked over his shoulder.
"There, sir," I timidly explained. "Also Georgiana. That's my mother."
"Oh," said he, coming back. "And is that your father or longer your mother?"
"Yes, sir," said I, "him too, late of this parish."
"Ha," he muttered then, considering. "Who do you live with, supposing you're kindly let to live, which I ha'n't made up my mind about?"
"My sister, sir, Mrs. Jo Gargery, wife of Jo Gargery, the blacksmith, sir."
"Blacksmith, eh?" said he, and looked down at his leg. After darkly looking at his leg and me several times, he came closer to my tombstone, took me by both arms, and tilted me back as far as he could hold me, so that his eyes looked most powerfully down into mine, and mine looked most helplessly up into his. "Now looky here," he said,
the question being whether you're to be let to live. You know what a file is?
Yes, sir.
And you know what whittles is?
Yes, sir.
After each question he tilted me over a little more, so as to give me a greater sense of helplessness and danger. You get me a file. He tilted me again. And you get me whittles. He tilted me again. You bring them both to me. He tilted me again. Or I'll have your heart and liver out. He tilted me again. I was dreadfully frightened, and so giddy that I clung to him with both hands, and said, "If you would kindly please to let me keep upright, sir, perhaps I shouldn't be sick, and perhaps I could attend more." He gave me a most tremendous dip and roll, so that the church jumped over its own weathercock. Then, he held me by the arms, in an upright position on the top of the stone, and went on in these fearful terms, dash. "You bring me, tomorrow morning early, that file and them whittles. You bring the lot to me, at that old battery over yonder. You do it, and you never dare to say a word or dare to make a sign concerning your having seen such a person as me, or any person soomever, and you shall be let to live. You fail, or you go from my words in any particular, no matter how small it is, and your heart and your liver shall be tore out, roasted, and ate. Now, I ain't alone, as you may think I am. There's a young man hid with me, in comparison with which young man I am a angel. That young man hears the words I speak. That young man has a secret way peculiar to himself, of getting at a boy, and at his heart, and at his liver. It is in vain for a boy to attempt to hide himself from that young man. A boy may lock his door, may be warm in bed, may tuck himself up, may draw the clothes over his head, may think himself comfortable and safe, but that young man will softly creep and creep his way to him and tear him open. I am a-keeping that young man from harming of you at the present moment, with great difficulty. I find it wary hard to hold that young man off of your inside. Now, what do you say?" I said that I would get him the file, and I would get him what broken bits of food I could, and I would come to him at the battery, early in the morning. "Say Lord strike you dead if you don't," said the man. I said so, and he took me down. "Now," he pursued, "you remember what you've undertook, and you remember that young man, and you get home." "Good night, sir," I faltered. "Much of that," said he, glancing about him over the cold wet flat. "I wish I was a frog. Or a eel." At the same time, he hugged his shuddering body in both his arms, clasping himself, as if to hold himself together, and limped towards the low church wall. As I saw him go, picking his way among the nettles, and among the brambles that bound the green mounds, he looked in my young eyes as if he were eluding the hands of the dead people, stretching up cautiously out of their graves, to get a twist upon his ankle and pull him in. When he came to the low church wall, he got over it, like a man whose legs were numbed and stiff, and then turned round to look for me. When I saw him turning, I set my face towards home, and made the best use of my legs. But presently I looked over my shoulder, and saw him going on again towards the river, still hugging himself in both arms, and picking his way with his sore feet among the great stones dropped into the marshes here and there, for stepping places when the rains were heavy or the tide was in. The marshes were just a long black horizontal line then, as I stopped to look after him, and the river was just another horizontal line, not nearly so broad nor yet so black, and the sky was just a row of long angry red lines and dense black lines intermixed. On the edge of the river I could faintly make out the only two black things in all the prospect that seemed to be standing upright. One of these was the beacon by which the sailors steered, like an unhooped cask upon a pole, an ugly thing when you were near it, the other, a gibbet, with some chains hanging to it which had once held a pirate. The man was limping on towards this ladder, as if he were the pirate come to life, and come down, and going back to hook himself up again. It gave me a terrible turn when I thought so, and as I saw the cattle lifting their heads to gaze after him, I wondered whether they thought so too. I looked all round for the horrible young man, and could see no signs of him. But now I was frightened again, and ran home without stopping. Chapter 2. My sister, Mrs. Jo Gargery, was more than 20 years older than I, and had established a great reputation with herself and the neighbors because she had brought me up by hand. Having at that time to find out for myself what the expression meant, and knowing her to have a hard and heavy hand, and to be much in the habit of laying it upon her husband as well as upon me, I suppose that Jo Gargery and I were both brought up by hand. She was not a good-looking woman, my sister, and I had a general impression that she must have made Jo Gargery marry her by hand. Jo was a fair man, with curls of flaxen hair on each side of his smooth face, and with eyes of such a very undecided blue that they seemed to have somehow got mixed with their own whites. He was a mild, good-natured, sweet-tempered, easy-going, foolish, dear fellow, a sort of Hercules in strength, and also in weakness. My sister, Mrs. Jo, with black hair and eyes, had such a prevailing redness of skin that I sometimes used to wonder whether it was possible she washed herself with a nutmeg grater instead of soap. She was tall and bony, and almost always wore a coarse apron, fastened over her figure behind with two loops, and having a square impregnable bib in front, that was stuck full of pins and needles. She made it a powerful merit in herself, and a strong reproach against Jo, that she wore this apron so much. Though I really see no reason why she should have worn it at all, or why, if she did wear it at all, she should not have taken it off, every day of her life. Jo's forge adjoined our house, which was a wooden house, as many of the dwellings in our country were, most of them, at that time. When I ran home from the churchyard, the forge was shut up, and Jo was sitting alone in the kitchen. Jo and I being fellow sufferers, and having confidences as such, Jo imparted a confidence to me, the moment I raised the latch of the door and peeped in at him opposite to it, sitting in the chimney corner. Mrs. Jo has been out a dozen times, looking for you, Pip. And she's out now, making it a baker's dozen.
Is she?
Yes, Pip, said Jo, and what's worse, she's got Tickler with her. At this dismal intelligence, I twisted the only button on my waistcoat round and round, and looked in great depression at the fire. Tickler was a wax-ended piece of cane, worn smooth by collision with my tickled frame. She sat down, said Jo, and she got up, and she made a grab at Tickler, and she rampaged out. That's what she did, said Jo, slowly clearing the fire between the lower bars with the poker, and looking at it, she rampaged out, Pip. Has she been gone long, Jo? I always treated him as a larger species of child, and as no more than my equal. Well, said Jo, glancing up at the Dutch clock, she's been on the rampage, this last spell, about 5 minutes, Pip. She's a-coming. Get behind the door, old chap, and have the jack towel betwixt you. I took the advice. My sister, Mrs. Jo, throwing the door wide open, and finding an obstruction behind it, immediately divined the cause, and applied Tickler to its further investigation. She concluded by throwing the eye off and served as a connubial missile at Jo, who, glad to get hold of me on any terms, passed me on into the chimney and quietly fenced me up there with his great leg. Where have you been, you young monkey? Said Mrs. Jo, stamping her foot. Tell me directly what you've been doing to wear me away with fret and fright and worrit, or I'd have you out of that corner if you was 50 pips, and he was 500 gargaries. I have only been to the churchyard, said I, from my stool, crying and rubbing myself. Churchyard, repeated my sister. If it weren't for me you'd have been to the churchyard long ago, and stayed there. Who brought you up by hand? You did, said I. And why did I do it, I should like to know? Exclaimed my sister. I whimpered, I don't know. I don't, said my sister. I'd never do it again. I know that. I may truly say I've never had this apron of mine off since born you were. It's bad enough to be a blacksmith's wife, and him a gargery, without being your mother. My thoughts strayed from that question as I looked disconsolately at the fire. For the fugitive out on the marshes with the iron leg, the mysterious young man, the file, the food, and the dreadful pledge I was under to commit a larceny on those sheltering premises, rose before me in the avenging coals. Ha! Said Mrs. Jo, restoring Tickler to his station. Churchyard, indeed. You may well say churchyard, you too. One of us, by the by, had not said it at all. You'll drive me to the churchyard betwixt you, one of these days, and oh, a precious pair you'd be without me. As she applied herself to set the tea things, Jo peeped down at me over his leg, as if he were mentally casting me and himself up, and calculating what kind of pair we practically should make, under the grievous circumstances foreshadowed. After that, he sat feeling his right side flaxen curls and whisker, and following Mrs. Jo about with his blue eyes, as his manner always was at squally times. My sister had a trenchant way of cutting our bread and butter for us, that never varied. First, with her left hand she jammed the loaf hard and fast against her bib, where it sometimes got a pin into it, and sometimes a needle, which we afterwards got into our mouths. Then she took some butter, not too much, on a knife and spread it on the loaf, in an apothecary kind of way, as if she were making a plaster, using both sides of the knife with a slapping dexterity, and trimming and molding the butter off round the crust. Then, she gave the knife a final smart wipe on the edge of the plaster, and then sawed a very thick round off the loaf, which she finally, before separating from the loaf, hewed into two halves, of which Jo got one, and I the other. On the present occasion, though I was hungry, I dared not eat my slice. I felt that I must have something in reserve for my dreadful acquaintance, and his ally the still more dreadful young man. I knew Mrs. Joe's housekeeping to be of the strictest kind, and that my larcenous researches might find nothing available in the safe. Therefore I resolved to put my hunk of bread and butter down the leg of my trousers. The effort of resolution necessary to the achievement of this purpose I found to be quite awful. It was as if I had to make up my mind to leap from the top of a high house, or plunge into a great depth of water. And it was made the more difficult by the unconscious Joe. In our already mentioned Freemasonry as fellow sufferers, and in his good-natured companionship with me, it was our evening habit to compare the way we bit through our slices, by silently holding them up to each other's admiration now and then, which stimulated us to new exertions. Tonight, Joe several times invited me, by the display of his fast diminishing slice, to enter upon our usual friendly competition, but he found me, each time, with my yellow mug of tea on one knee, and my untouched bread and butter on the other. At last, I desperately considered that the thing I contemplated must be done, and that it had best be done in the least improbable manner consistent with the circumstances. I took advantage of a moment when Joe had just looked at me, and got my bread and butter down my leg. Joe was evidently made uncomfortable by what he supposed to be my loss of appetite, and took a thoughtful bite out of his slice, which he didn't seem to enjoy. He turned it about in his mouth much longer than usual, pondering over it a good deal, and after all gulped it down like a pill. He was about to take another bite, and had just got his head on one side for a good purchase on it, when his eye fell on me, and he saw that my bread and butter was gone. The wonder and consternation with which Joe stopped on the threshold of his bite and stared at me, were too evident to escape my sister's observation. "What's the matter now?" said she, smartly, as she put down her cup. "I say, you know," muttered Joe, shaking his head at me in very serious remonstrance. "Pip, old chap. You'll do yourself a mischief. It'll stick somewhere. You can't have chawed it, Pip." "What's the matter now?" repeated my sister, more sharply than before. "If you can cough any trifle on it up, Pip, I'd recommend you to do it," said Joe, all aghast. "Manners is manners, but still your oath's your oath." By this time, my sister was quite desperate, so she pounced on Joe, and, taking him by the two whiskers, knocked his head for a little while against the wall behind him, while I sat in the corner, looking guiltily on. "Now, perhaps you'll mention what's the matter," said my sister, out of breath, "you staring great stuck pig." Joe looked at her in a helpless way, then took a helpless bite, and looked at me again. "You know, Pip," said Joe, solemnly, with his last bite in his cheek, and speaking in a confidential voice, as if we two were quite alone, "you and me is always friends, and I'd be the last to tell upon you, any time. But such a—" he moved his chair and looked about the floor between us, and then again at me, "such a most uncommon bolt as that." "Been bolting his food, has he?" cried my sister. "You know, old chap," said Joe, looking at me, and not at Mrs. Joe, with his bite still in his cheek, "I bolted, myself, when I was your age frequent, and as a boy I've been among a many bolters, but I never see your bolting equal yet, Pip, and it's a mercy you ain't bolted dead." My sister made a dive at me, and fished me up by the hair, saying nothing more than the awful words, "You come along and be dosed." Some medical beast had revived tar water in those days as a fine medicine, and Mrs. Joe always kept a supply of it in the cupboard, having a belief in its virtues correspondent to its nastiness. At the best of times, so much of this elixir was administered to me as a choice restorative, that I was conscious of going about, smelling like a new fence. On this particular evening the urgency of my case demanded a pint of this mixture, which was poured down my throat, for my greater comfort, while Mrs. Joe held my head under her arm, as a boot would be held in a bootjack. Joe got off with half a pint, but was made to swallow that, much to his disturbance, as he sat slowly munching and meditating before the fire, because he had had a turn. Judging from myself, I should say he certainly had a turn afterwards, if he had had none before. Conscience is a dreadful thing when it accuses man or boy, but when, in the case of a boy, that secret burden cooperates with another secret burden down the leg of his trousers, it is, as I can testify, a great punishment. The guilty knowledge that I was going to rob Mrs. Joe, I never thought I was going to rob Joe, for I never thought of any of the housekeeping property as is united to the necessity of always keeping one hand on my bread and butter as I sat, or when I was ordered about the kitchen on any small errand, almost drove me out of my mind. Then, as the marsh winds made the fire glow and flare, I thought I heard the voice outside, of the man with the iron on his leg who had sworn me to secrecy, declaring that he couldn't and wouldn't starve until tomorrow, but must be fed now. At other times, I thought, What if the young man who is with so much difficulty restrained from imbruing his hands in me should yield to a constitutional impatience, or should mistake the time, and should think himself accredited to my heart and liver tonight, instead of tomorrow? If ever anybody's hair stood on end with terror, mine must have done so then. But, perhaps, nobody's ever did? It was Christmas Eve, and I had to stir the pudding for next day, with a copper stick, from 7 to 8 by the Dutch clock. I tried it with the load upon my leg, and that made me think afresh of the man with the load on his leg, and found the tendency of exercise to bring the bread and butter out at my ankle, quite unmanageable. Happily I slipped away, and deposited that part of my conscience in my garret bedroom. "Hark!" said I, when I had done my stirring, and was taking a final warm in the chimney corner before being sent up to bed, "was that great guns, Joe?"
"Ah," said Joe, "there's another convict off."
"What does that mean, Joe?" said I. Mrs. Joe, who always took explanations upon herself, said, snappishly, "escaped. Escaped." Administering the definition like tar water. While Mrs. Joe sat with her head bending over her needlework, I put my mouth into the forms of saying to Joe, "What's a convict?" Joe put his mouth into the forms of returning such a highly elaborate answer, that I could make out nothing of it but the single word pip. "There was a convict off last night," said Joe, "aloud, after sunset gun. And they fired warning of him. And now it appears they're firing warning of another."
"Who's firing?"
said I. "Drat that boy," interposed my sister, frowning at me over her work, "what a questioner he is. Ask no questions, and you'll be told no lies." It was not very polite to herself, I thought, to imply that I should be told lies by her even if I did ask questions. But she never was polite unless there was company. At this point Joe greatly augmented my curiosity by taking the utmost pains to open his mouth very wide, and to put it into the form of a word that looked to me like sulks. Therefore, I naturally pointed to Mrs. Joe, and put my mouth into the form of saying, "her?" But Joe wouldn't hear of that, at all, and again opened his mouth very wide, and shook the form of a most emphatic word out of it. But I could make nothing of the word. "Mrs. Joe," said I, "as a last resort, I should like to know if you wouldn't much mind where the firing comes from."
"Lord bless the boy!" exclaimed my sister, as if she didn't quite mean that but rather the contrary. "From the hulks."
"Oh," said I, looking at Joe. "Hulks?" Joe gave a reproachful cough, as much as to say, "Well, I told you so."
"And please, what's hulks?" said I.
"That's the way with this boy," exclaimed my sister, pointing me out with her needle and thread, and shaking her head at me. "Answer him one question, and he'll ask you a dozen directly. Hulks are prison ships, right cross TH meshes. We always use the name for marshes, in our country." "I wonder who's put into prison ships, and why they're put there," said I, in a general way, and with quiet desperation. It was too much for Mrs. Joe, who immediately rose. "I tell you what, young fellow," said she, "I didn't bring you up by hand to badger people's lives out. It would be blame to me and not praise, if I had. People are put in the hulks because they murder, and because they rob, and forge, and do all sorts of bad, and they always begin by asking questions. Now, you get along to bed." I was never allowed a candle to light me to bed, and, as I went upstairs in the dark, with my head tingling, from Mrs. Joe's thimble having played the tambourine upon it, to accompany her last words, I felt fearfully sensible of the great convenience that the hulks were handy for me. I was clearly on my way there. I had begun by asking questions, and I was going to rob Mrs. Joe. Since that time, which is far enough away now, I have often thought that few people know what secrecy there is in the young under terror. No matter how unreasonable the terror, so that it be terror. I was in mortal terror of the young man who wanted my heart and liver, I was in mortal terror of my interlocutor with the iron leg, I was in mortal terror of myself, from whom an awful promise had been extracted. I had no hope of deliverance through my all-powerful sister, who repulsed me at every turn. I am afraid to think of what I might have done on a requirement, in the secrecy of my terror. If I slept at all that night, it was only to imagine myself drifting down the river on a strong spring tide, to the hulks, a ghostly pirate calling out to me through a speaking trumpet, as I passed the gibbet station, that I had better come ashore and be hanged there at once, and not put it off. I was afraid to sleep, even if I had been inclined, for I knew that at the first faint dawn of morning I must rob the pantry. There was no doing it in the night, for there was no getting a light by easy friction then. To have got one I must have struck it out of flint and steel, and have made a noise like the very pirate himself rattling his chains.
As soon as the great black velvet pall outside my little window was shot with gray, I got up and went downstairs, every board upon the way, and every crack in every board calling after me, "Stop thief! And get up, Mrs. Joe!" In the pantry, which was far more abundantly supplied than usual, owing to the season, I was very much alarmed by a hare hanging up by the heels, whom I rather thought I caught, when my back was half turned, winking. I had no time for verification, no time for selection, no time for anything, for I had no time to spare. I stole some bread, some rind of cheese, about half a jar of mincemeat, which I tied up in my pocket handkerchief with my last night's slice, some brandy from a stone bottle, which I decanted into a glass bottle I had secretly used for making that intoxicating fluid, Spanish licorice water, up in my room, diluting the stone bottle from a jug in the kitchen cupboard, a meat bone with very little on it, and a beautiful round compact pork pie. I was nearly going away without the pie, but I was tempted to mount upon a shelf, to look what it was that was put away so carefully in a covered earthenware dish in a corner, and I found it was the pie, and I took it in the hope that it was not intended for early use, and would not be missed for some time. There was a door in the kitchen, communicating with the forge. I unlocked and unbolted that door, and got a file from among Joe's tools. Then I put the fastenings as I had found them, opened the door at which I had entered when I ran home last night, shut it, and ran for the misty marshes. Chapter 3. It was a rimy morning, and very damp. I had seen the damp lying on the outside of my little window, as if some goblin had been crying there all night, and using the window for a pocket handkerchief. Now, I saw the damp lying on the bare hedges and spare grass, like a coarser sort of spider's webs, hanging itself from twig to twig and blade to blade. On every rail and gate, wet lay clammy, and the marsh mist was so thick, that the wooden finger on the post directing people to our village, a direction which they never accepted, for they never came there, was invisible to me until I was quite close under it. Then, as I looked up at it, while it dripped, it seemed to my oppressed conscience like a phantom devoting me to the hulks. The mist was heavier yet when I got out upon the marshes, so that instead of my running at everything, everything seemed to run at me. This was very disagreeable to a guilty mind. The gates and dikes and banks came bursting at me through the mist, as if they cried as plainly as could be, "A boy with somebody else's pork pie. Stop him." The cattle came upon me with like suddenness, staring out of their eyes, and steaming out of their nostrils, "Holloa, young thief." One black ox, with a white cravat on, who even had to my awakened conscience something of a clerical air, fixed me so obstinately with his eyes, and moved his blunt head round in such an accusatory manner as I moved round, that I blubbered out to him, "I couldn't help it, sir. It wasn't for myself I took it." Upon which he put down his head, blew a cloud of smoke out of his nose, and vanished with a kick up of his hind legs and a flourish of his tail. All this time, I was getting on towards the river, but however fast I went, I couldn't warm my feet, to which the damp cold seemed riveted, as the iron was riveted to the leg of the man I was running to meet. I knew my way to the battery, pretty straight, for I had been down there on a Sunday with Joe, and Joe, sitting on an old gun, had told me that when I was prenticed to him, regularly bound, we would have such larks there. However, in the confusion of the mist, I found myself at last too far to the right, and consequently had to try back along the riverside, on the bank of loose stones above the mud and the stakes that staked the tide out. Making my way along here with all dispatch, I had just crossed a ditch which I knew to be very near the battery, and had just scrambled up the mound beyond the ditch, when I saw the man sitting before me. His back was towards me, and he had his arms folded, and was nodding forward, heavy with sleep. I thought he would be more glad if I came upon him with his breakfast, in that unexpected manner, so I went forward softly and touched him on the shoulder. He instantly jumped up, and it was not the same man, but another man. And yet this man was dressed in coarse gray, too, and had a great iron on his leg, and was lame, and hoarse, and cold, and was everything that the other man was, except that he had not the same face, and had a flat broad-brimmed low-crowned felt hat on. All this I saw in a moment, for I had only a moment to see it in. He swore an oath at me, made a hit at me, it was a round weak blow that missed me and almost knocked himself down, for it made him stumble, and then he ran into the mist, stumbling twice as he went, and I lost him. "It's the young man," I thought, feeling my heart shoot as I identified him. I dare say I should have felt a pain in my liver, too, if I had known where it was. I was soon at the battery after that, and there was the right man, hugging himself and limping to and fro, as if he had never all night left off hugging and limping, waiting for me. He was awfully cold, to be sure. I half expected to see him drop down before my face and die of deadly cold. His eyes looked so awfully hungry too, that when I handed him the file and he laid it down on the grass, it occurred to me he would have tried to eat it, if he had not seen my bundle. He did not turn me upside down this time to get at what I had, but left me right side upwards while I opened the bundle and emptied my pockets.
"What's in the bottle, boy?" said he.
"Brandy," said I. He was already handing mincemeat down his throat in the most curious manner, more like a man who was putting it away somewhere in a violent hurry, than a man who was eating it, but he left off to take some of the liquor. He shivered all the while so violently, that it was quite as much as he could do to keep the neck of a bottle between his teeth, without biting it off.
"I think you have got the ague," said I.
"I'm much of your opinion, boy," said he. "It's bad about here," I told him. "You've been lying out on the meshes, and they're dreadful aguish. Rheumatic too. I'll eat my breakfast afore they're the death of me," said he. "I do that, if I was going to be strung up to that there gallows as there is over there, directly afterwards. I'll beat the shivers so far, I'll bet you." He was gobbling mince meat, meat bone, bread, cheese, and pork pie, all at once, staring distrustfully while he did so at the mist all round us, and often stopping his jaws to listen. Some real or fancied sound, some clink upon the river or breathing of beast upon the marsh, now gave him a start, and he said, suddenly, "Dash. You're not a deceiving imp? You brought no one with you?"
"No, sir. No."
"Nor give no one the office to follow you?"
"No."
"Well," said he, "I believe you. You'd be but a fierce young hound indeed, if at your time of life you could help to hunt a wretched warmint hunted as near death and dunghill as this poor wretched warmint is." Something clicked in his throat as if he had works in him like a clock, and was going to strike. And he smeared his ragged rough sleeve over his eyes. Pitying his desolation, and watching him as he gradually settled down upon the pie, I made bold to say, "I am glad you enjoy it."
"Did you speak?"
"I said I was glad you enjoyed it."
"Thank'ee, my boy. I do."
I had often watched a large dog of ours eating his food, and I now noticed a decided similarity between the dog's way of eating, and the man's. The man took strong sharp sudden bites, just like the dog. He swallowed, or rather snapped up, every mouthful, too soon and too fast, and he looked sideways here and there while he ate, as if he thought there was danger in every direction of somebody's coming to take the pie away. He was altogether too unsettled in his mind over it, to appreciate it comfortably I thought, or to have anybody to dine with him, without making a chop with his jaws at the visitor. In all of which particulars he was very like the dog. "I'm afraid you won't leave any of it for him," said I, timidly, after a silence during which I had hesitated as to the politeness of making the remark. There's no more to be got where that came from. It was the certainty of this fact that impelled me to offer the hint.
"Leave any for him?
Who's him?" said my friend, stopping in his crunching of pie crust.
"The young man. That you spoke of. That was hit with you."
"Oh ah," he returned, with something like a gruff laugh.
"Him?
Yes, yes. He don't want no wittles."
"I thought he looked as if he did," said I.
The man stopped eating, and regarded me with the keenest scrutiny and the greatest surprise.
"Looked?
When?"
"Just now."
"Where?"
"Yonder,"
said I, pointing, "over there, where I found him nodding asleep, and thought it was you." He held me by the collar and stared at me so, that I began to think his first idea about cutting my throat had revived.
"Dress like you, you know, only with a hat," I explained, trembling, and I was very anxious to put this delicately and with the same reason for wanting to borrow a file.
"Didn't you hear the cannon last night?
Then there was firing," he said to himself.
"I wonder you shouldn't have been sure of that," I returned, "for we heard it up at home, and that's farther away, and we were shut in besides."
"Why, see now," said he. "When a man's alone on these flats, with a light head and a light stomach, perishing of cold and want, he hears nothing all night, but guns firing, and voices calling.
Hears?
He sees the soldiers, with their red coats lighted up by the torches carried afore, closing in round him. Hears his number called, hears himself challenged, hears the rattle of the muskets, hears the orders make ready.
Present.
Cover him steady, men. And is laid hands on and there's nothing.
Why, if I see one pursuing party last night coming up in order, damn him, with their tramp, tramp I see 100.
And as to firing.
Why, I see the mist shake with the cannon, arter it was broad day, but this man, he had said all the rest, as if he had forgotten my being there, did you notice anything in him?"
"He had a badly bruised face," said I, recalling what I hardly knew I knew.
"Not here?" exclaimed the man, striking his left cheek mercilessly, with the flat of his hand.
Yes, there. Where is he? He crammed what little food was left into the breast of his gray jacket.
Show me the way he went. I'll pull him down, like a bloodhound. Curse this iron on my sore leg. Give us hold of the file, boy.
I indicated in what direction the mist had shrouded the other man, and he looked up at it for an instant. But he was down on the rank wet grass, filing at his iron like a madman, and not minding me or minding his own leg, which had an old chafe upon it and was bloody, but which he handled as roughly as if it had no more feeling in it than the file. I was very much afraid of him again, now that he had worked himself into this fierce hurry, and I was likewise very much afraid of keeping away from home any longer. I told him I must go, but he took no notice, so I thought the best thing I could do was to slip off. The last I saw of him, his head was bent over his knee and he was working hard at his fetter, muttering impatient imprecations at it and at his leg. The last I heard of him, I stopped in the mist to listen, and the file was still going. Chapter 4. I fully expected to find a constable in the kitchen, waiting to take me up. But not only was there no constable there, but no discovery had yet been made of the robbery. Mrs. Joe was prodigiously busy in getting the house ready for the festivities of the day, and Joe had been put upon the kitchen doorstep to keep him out of the dustpan, an article into which his destiny always led him, sooner or later, when my sister was vigorously reaping the floors of her establishment. "And where the deuce ha' you been?" was Mrs. Joe's Christmas salutation, when I and my conscience showed ourselves. I said I had been down to hear the carols.
"Ah! Well," observed Mrs. Joe, "you might ha' done worse."
"Not a doubt of that," I thought. "Perhaps if I weren't a blacksmith's wife, and, what's the same thing, a slave with her apron never off, I should have been to hear the carols," said Mrs. Joe. "I'm rather partial to carols, myself, and that's the best of reasons for my never hearing any." Joe, who had ventured into the kitchen after me as the dustpan had retired before us, drew the back of his hand across his nose with a conciliatory air, when Mrs. Joe darted a look at him, and, when her eyes were withdrawn, secretly crossed his two forefingers, and exhibited them to me, as our token that Mrs. Joe was in a cross temper. This was so much her normal state, that Joe and I would often, for weeks together, be, as to our fingers, like monumental crusaders as to their legs. We were to have a superb dinner, consisting of a leg of pickled pork and greens, and a pair of roast stuffed fowls. A handsome mince pie had been made yesterday morning, which accounted for the mincemeat not being missed, and the pudding was already on the boil. These extensive arrangements occasioned us to be cut off unceremoniously in respect of breakfast, "for I ain't," said Mrs. Joe, "I ain't a-going to have no formal cramming and busting and washing up now, with what I've got before me, I promise you." So, we had our slices served out, as if we were 2,000 troops on a forced march instead of a man and boy at home, and we took gulps of milk and water, with apologetic countenances, from a jug on the dresser. In the meantime, Mrs. Joe put clean white curtains up, and tacked a new flowered flounce across the wide chimney to replace the old one, and uncovered the little state parlor across the passage, which was never uncovered at any other time, but passed the rest of the year in a cool haze of silver paper, which even extended to the four little white crockery poodles on the mantelshelf, each with a black nose and a basket of flowers in his mouth, and each the counterpart of the other. Mrs. Joe was a very clean housekeeper, but had an exquisite art of making her cleanliness more uncomfortable and unacceptable than dirt itself. Cleanliness is next to godliness, and some people do the same by their religion. My sister, having so much to do, was going to church vicariously, that is to say, Joe and I were going. In his working clothes, Joe was a well-knit characteristic-looking blacksmith; in his holiday clothes, he was more like a scarecrow in good circumstances, than anything else. Nothing that he wore then fitted him or seemed to belong to him, and everything that he wore then grazed him. On the present festive occasion he emerged from his room, when the blithe bells were going, the picture of misery, in a full suit of Sunday penitentials. As to me, I think my sister must have had some general idea that I was a young offender whom an accoucheur policeman had taken up, on my birthday, and delivered over to her, to be dealt with according to the outraged majesty of the law. I was always treated as if I had insisted on being born in opposition to the dictates of reason, religion, and morality, and against the dissuading arguments of my best friends. Even when I was taken to have a new suit of clothes, the tailor had orders to make them like a kind of reformatory, and on no account to let me have the free use of my limbs. Joe and I going to church, therefore, must have been a moving spectacle for compassionate minds. Yet, what I suffered outside was nothing to what I underwent within. The terrors that had assailed me whenever Mrs. Joe had gone near the pantry, or out of the room, were only to be equaled by the remorse with which my mind dwelt on what my hands had done. Under the weight of my wicked secret, I pondered whether the church would be powerful enough to shield me from the vengeance of the terrible young man, if I divulged to that establishment. I conceived the idea that the time when the banns were read and when the clergyman said, "Ye are now to declare it," would be the time for me to rise and propose a private conference in the vestry. I am far from being sure that I might not have astonished our small congregation by resorting to this extreme measure, but for its being Christmas Day and no Sunday. Mr. Wopsle, the clerk at church, was to dine with us, and Mr. Hubble the wheelwright and Mrs. Hubble, and Uncle Pumblechook, Joe's uncle, but Mrs. Joe appropriated him, who was a well-to-do corn chandler in the nearest town, and drove his own chaise cart. The dinner hour was 1:30. When Joe and I got home, we found the table laid, and Mrs. Joe dressed, and the dinner dressing, and the front door unlocked. It never was at any other time, for the company to enter by, and everything most splendid. And still, not a word of the robbery. The time came, without bringing with it any relief to my feelings, and the company came. Mr. Wopsle, united to a Roman nose and a large shining bald forehead, had a deep voice which he was uncommonly proud of. Indeed, it was understood among his acquaintance that if you could only give him his head, he would read the clergyman into fits. He himself confessed that if the church was thrown open, meaning to competition, he would not despair of making his mark in it. The church not being thrown open, he was, as I have said, our clerk. But he punished the amens tremendously, and when he gave out the psalm, always giving the whole verse, he looked all round the congregation first, as much as to say, "You have heard my friend overhead, oblige me with your opinion of this style." I opened the door to the company, making believe that it was a habit of ours to open the door, and I opened it first to Mr. Wopsle, next to Mr. and Mrs. Hubble, and last of all to Uncle Pumblechook. N.B.I. was not allowed to call him uncle, under the severest penalties. "Mrs. Joe," said Uncle Pumblechook, a large hard-breathing middle-aged slow man, with a mouth like a fish, dull staring eyes, and sandy hair standing upright on his head, so that he looked as if he had just been all but choked, and had that moment come too, "I have brought you, as the compliments of the season, I have brought you, mum, a bottle of sherry wine, and I have brought you, mum, a bottle of port wine." Every Christmas Day he presented himself, as a profound novelty, with exactly the same words, and carrying the two bottles like dumbbells. Every Christmas Day, Mrs. Joe replied, as she now replied, "Oh, Uncle Pumblechook, this is kind." Every Christmas Day, he retorted, as he now retorted, "It's no more than your merits. And now are you all bobbish, and how's sixpenn'orth of halfpence?" meaning me. We dined on these occasions in the kitchen, and adjourned, for the nuts and oranges and apples, to the parlor, which was a change very like Joe's change from his working clothes to his Sunday dress. My sister was uncommonly lively on the present occasion, and indeed was generally more gracious in the society of Mrs. Hubble than in other company. I remember Mrs. Hubble as a little curly sharp-edged person in sky blue, who held a conventionally juvenile position, because she had married Mr. Hubble, I don't know at what remote period, when she was much younger than he. I remember Mr. Hubble as a tough, high-shouldered, stooping old man, of a sawdusty fragrance, with his legs extraordinarily wide apart, so that in my short days I always saw some miles of open country between them when I met him coming up the lane. Among this good company I should have felt myself, even if I hadn't robbed the pantry, in a false position. Not because I was squeezed in at an acute angle of the tablecloth, with the table in my chest, and the Pumblechookian elbow in my eye, nor because I was not allowed to speak, I didn't want to speak, nor because I was regaled with the scaly tips of the drumsticks of the fowls, and with those obscure corners of pork of which the pig, when living, had had the least reason to be vain. No, I should not have minded that, if they would only have left me alone. But they wouldn't leave me alone. They seemed to think the opportunity lost, if they failed to point the conversation at me, every now and then, and stick the point into me. I might have been an unfortunate little bull in a Spanish arena, I got so smartingly touched up by these moral goads. It began the moment we sat down to dinner. Mr. Wopsle said grace with theatrical declamation, as it now appears to me, something like a religious cross of the ghost in Hamlet with Richard III, and ended with the very proper aspiration that we might be truly grateful. Upon which my sister fixed me with her eye, and said, in a low reproachful voice, "Do you hear that? Be grateful." "Especially," said Mr. Pumblechook, "be grateful, boy, to them which brought you up by hand." Mrs. Hubble shook her head, and contemplating me with a mournful presentiment that I should come to no good, asked, "Why is it that the young are never grateful?" This mortal mystery seemed too much for the company until Mr. Hubble tersely solved it by saying, "Naturally wishes." Everybody then murmured true, and looked at me in a particularly unpleasant and personal manner. Joe's station and influence were something feebler, if possible, when there was company than when there was none. But he always aided and comforted me when he could, in some way of his own, and he always did so at dinner time by giving me gravy, if there were any. There being plenty of gravy today, Joe spooned into my plate, at this point, about half a pint. A little later on in the dinner, Mr. Wopsle reviewed the sermon with some severity, and intimated in the usual hypothetical case of the church being thrown open what kind of sermon he would have given them. After favoring them with some heads of that discourse, he remarked that he considered the subject of the day's homily ill-chosen, which was the less excusable, he added, when there were so many subjects going about. "True again," said Uncle Pumblechook. "You've hit it, sir. Plenty of subjects going about, for them that know how to put salt upon their tails. That's what's wanted. A man needn't go far to find a subject, if he's ready with his salt box." Mr. Pumblechook added, after a short interval of reflection, "Look at pork alone. There's a subject. If you want a subject, look at pork." "True, sir. Many a moral for the young," returned Mr. Wopsle, and I knew he was going to lug me in, before he said it, might be deduced from that text. "You listen to this," said my sister to me, in a severe parenthesis. Joe gave me some more gravy. "Swine," pursued Mr. Wopsle, in his deepest voice, and pointing his fork at my blushes, as if he were mentioning my Christian name, "swine were the companions of the prodigal. The gluttony of swine is put before us, as an example to the young." I thought this pretty well in him who had been praising up the pork for being so plump and juicy. What is detestable in a pig is more detestable in a boy. "Or girl," suggested Mr. Hubble. "Of course, or girl, Mr. Hubble," assented Mr. Wopsle, rather irritably, "but there is no girl present." "Besides," said Mr. Pumblechook, turning sharp on me, "think what you've got to be grateful for. If you'd been born a squeaker." "He was, if ever a child was," said my sister, most emphatically. Joe gave me some more gravy. "Well, but I mean a four-footed squeaker," said Mr. Pumblechook. "If you had been born such, would you have been here now? Not you." "Unless in that form," said Mr. Wopsle, nodding towards the dish. "But I don't mean in that form, sir," returned Mr. Pumblechook, who had an objection to being interrupted. "I mean, enjoying himself with his elders and betters, and improving himself with their conversation, and rolling in the lap of luxury. Would he have been doing that?" "No, he wouldn't." "And what would have been your destination?" turning on me again. "You would have been disposed of for so many shillings according to the market price of the article, and Dunstable the butcher would have come up to you as you lay in your straw, and he would have whipped you under his left arm, and with his right he would have tucked up his frock to get a penknife from out of his waistcoat pocket, and he would have shed your blood and had your life. No bringing up by hand then. Not a bit of it." Joe offered me more gravy, which I was afraid to take. "He was a world of trouble to you, ma'am," said Mrs. Hubble, commiserating my sister. "Trouble?" echoed my sister, "trouble?" And then entered on a fearful catalogue of all the illnesses I had been guilty of, and all the acts of sleeplessness I had committed, and all the high places I had tumbled from, and all the low places I had tumbled into, and all the injuries I had done myself, and all the times she had wished me in my grave, and I had contumaciously refused to go there. I think the Romans must have aggravated one another very much, with their noses. Perhaps, they became the restless people they were, in consequence. Anyhow, Mr. Wopsle's Roman nose so aggravated me, during the recital of my misdemeanors, that I should have liked to pull it until he howled. But, all I had endured up to this time was nothing in comparison with the awful feelings that took possession of me when the pause was broken which ensued upon my sister's recital, and in which pause everybody had looked at me, as I felt painfully conscious, with indignation and abhorrence. "Yet," said Mr. Pumblechook, leading the company gently back to the theme from which they had strayed, "pork regarded as biled is rich, too, ain't it?" "Have a little brandy, uncle," said my sister. Oh heavens, it had come at last. He would find it was weak, he would say it was weak, and I was lost. I held tight to the leg of the table under the cloth, with both hands, and awaited my fate. My sister went for the stone bottle, came back with the stone bottle, and poured his brandy out, no one else taking any. The wretched man trifled with his glass, took it up, looked at it through the light, put it down, prolonged my misery. All this time Mrs. Joe and Joe were briskly clearing the table for the pie and pudding. I couldn't keep my eyes off him. Always holding tight by the leg of the table with my hands and feet, I saw the miserable creature finger his glass playfully, take it up, smile, throw his head back, and drink the brandy off. Instantly afterwards, the company were seized with unspeakable consternation, owing to his springing to his feet, turning round several times in an appalling spasmodic whooping cough dance, and rushing out at the door. He then became visible through the window, violently plunging and expectorating, making the most hideous faces, and apparently out of his mind. I held on tight, while Mrs. Joe and Joe ran to him. I didn't know how I had done it, but I had no doubt I had murdered him somehow. In my dreadful situation, it was a relief when he was brought back, and surveying the company all round as if they had disagreed with him, sank down into his chair with the one significant gasp, "Tar." I had filled up the bottle from the tar water jug. I knew he would be worse by and by. I moved the table, like a medium of the present day, by the vigor of my unseen hold upon it. "Tar!" cried my sister, in amazement. "Why, however could tar come there?" But Uncle Pumblechook, who was omnipotent in that kitchen, wouldn't hear the word, wouldn't hear of the subject, imperiously waved it all away with his hand, and asked for hot gin and water. My sister, who had begun to be alarmingly meditative, had to employ herself actively in getting the gin, the hot water, the sugar, and the lemon peel, and mixing them. For the time being at least, I was saved. I still held onto the leg of the table, but clutched it now with the fervor of gratitude. By degrees, I became calm enough to release my grasp and partake of pudding. Mr. Pumblechook partook of pudding. All partook of pudding. The course terminated, and Mr. Pumblechook had begun to beam under the genial influence of gin and water. I began to think I should get over the day, when my sister said to Joe, "Clean plates, cold." I clutched the leg of the table again immediately, and pressed it to my bosom as if it had been the companion of my youth and friend of my soul. I foresaw what was coming, and I felt that this time I really was gone. "You must taste," said my sister, addressing the guests with her best grace, "you must taste, to finish with, such a delightful and delicious present of Uncle Pumblechook's." "Must they? Let them not hope to taste it." "You must know," said my sister, rising, "it's a pie, a savory pork pie." The company murmured their compliments. Uncle Pumblechook, sensible of having deserved well of his fellow creatures, said, quite vivaciously, "All things considered, well, Mrs. Joe, we'll do our best endeavors, let us have a cut at this same pie." My sister went out to get it. I heard her steps proceed to the pantry. I saw Mr. Pumblechook balance his knife. I saw reawakening appetite in the Roman nostrils of Mr. Wopsle. I heard Mr. Hubble remark that a bit of savory pork pie would lay atop of anything you could mention, and do no harm, and I heard Joe say, "You shall have some, Pip." I have never been absolutely certain whether I uttered a shrill yell of terror, merely in spirit, or in the bodily hearing of the company. I felt that I could bear no more, and that I must run away. I released the leg of the table, and ran for my life. But I ran no farther than the house door, for there I ran head foremost into a party of soldiers with their muskets, one of whom held out a pair of handcuffs to me, saying, "Here you are, look sharp, come on." Chapter 5. The apparition of a file of soldiers ringing down the butt ends of their loaded muskets on our doorstep, caused the dinner party to rise from table in confusion, and caused Mrs. Joe, re-entering the kitchen empty-handed, to stop short and stare, in her wondering lament of "Gracious goodness gracious me, what's gone with the pie?" The sergeant and I were in the kitchen when Mrs. Joe stood staring, at which crisis I partially recovered the use of my senses. It was the sergeant who had spoken to me, and he was now looking round at the company, with his handcuffs invitingly extended towards them in his right hand, and his left on my shoulder. "Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen," said the sergeant, "but as I have mentioned at the door to this smart young shaver, which he hadn't, I am on a chase in the name of the king, and I want the blacksmith." "And pray what might you want with him?" retorted my sister, quick to resent his being wanted at all. "Missus," returned the gallant sergeant, "speaking for myself, I should reply, the honor and pleasure of his fine wife's acquaintance. Speaking for the king, I answer, a little job done." This was received as rather neat in the sergeant, insomuch that Mr. Pumblechook cried audibly, "Good again." "You see, blacksmith," said the sergeant, who had by this time picked out Joe with his eye, "we have had an accident with these, and I find the lock of one of 'em goes wrong, and the coupling don't act pretty. As they are wanted for immediate service, will you throw your eye over them?" Joe threw his eye over them, and pronounced that the job would necessitate the lighting of his forge fire, and would take nearer 2 hours than one. "Will it? Then will you set about it at once, blacksmith?" said the offhand sergeant, as it's on His Majesty's service. And if my men can bear hand anywhere, they'll make themselves useful." With that, he called to his men, who came trooping into the kitchen one after another, and piled their arms in a corner. And then they stood about, as soldiers do, now, with their hands loosely clasped before them, now, resting a knee or a shoulder, now, easing a belt or a pouch, now, opening the door to spit stiffly over their high stocks, out into the yard. All these things I saw without then knowing that I saw them, for I was in an agony of apprehension. But beginning to perceive that the handcuffs were not for me, and that the military had so far got the better of the pie as to put it in the background, I collected a little more of my scattered wits. "Would you give me the time?" said the sergeant, addressing himself to Mr. Pumblechook, as to a man whose appreciative powers justified the inference that he was equal to the time. "It's just gone 2:30. "That's not so bad," said the sergeant, reflecting, "even if I was forced to halt here nigh 2 hours, that'll do. How far might you call yourselves from the marshes, hereabouts?"
"Not above a mile, I reckon?"
"Just a mile," said Mrs. Joe. "That'll do. We begin to close in upon 'em about dusk. A little before dusk, my orders are."
"That'll do."
"Convicts, sergeant?" asked Mr. Wopsle, in a matter-of-course way.
"Aye," returned the sergeant, "too. They're pretty well known to be out on the marshes still, and they won't try to get clear of 'em before dusk. Anybody here seen anything of any such game?"
Everybody, myself excepted, said no, with confidence. Nobody thought of me.
"Well," said the sergeant, "they'll find themselves trapped in a circle, I expect, sooner than they count on. Now, blacksmith. If you're ready, His Majesty the King is."
Joe had got his coat and waistcoat and cravat off, and his leather apron on, and passed into the forge. One of the soldiers opened its wooden windows, another lighted the fire, another turned to at the bellows, the rest stood round the blaze, which was soon roaring. Then Joe began to hammer and clink, and we all looked on. The interest of the impending pursuit not only absorbed the general attention, but even made my sister liberal. She drew a pitcher of beer from the cask for the soldiers, and invited the sergeant to take a glass of brandy. But Mr. Pumblechook said, sharply, "Give him wine, mum. I'll engage there's no tar in that." So, the sergeant thanked him and said that as he preferred his drink without tar, he would take wine, if it was equally convenient. When it was given him, he drank His Majesty's health and compliments of the season, and took it all at a mouthful and smacked his lips.
"Good stuff, eh, sergeant?" said Mr. Pumblechook.
"I'll tell you something," returned the sergeant, "I suspect that stuff's of your providing." Mr. Pumblechook, with a fat sort of laugh, said, eh?
"Why?"
"Because," returned the sergeant, clapping him on the shoulder, "you're a man that knows what's what."
"Do you think so?" said Mr. Pumblechook, with his former laugh. "Have another glass."
"With you."
"Hobnob," returned the sergeant. "The top of mine to the foot of yours, the foot of yours to the top of mine, ring once, ring twice, the best tune on the musical glasses. Your health. May you live 1,000 years, and never be a worse judge of the right sort than you are at the present moment of your life."
The sergeant tossed off his glass again and seemed quite ready for another glass. I noticed that Mr. Pumblechook in his hospitality appeared to forget that he had made a present of the wine, but took the bottle from Mrs. Joe and had all the credit of handing it about in a gush of joviality. Even I got some. And he was so very free of the wine that he even called for the other bottle, and handed that about with the same liberality, when the first was gone. As I watched them while they all stood clustering about the forge, enjoying themselves so much, I thought what terrible good sauce for a dinner my fugitive friend on the marshes was. They had not enjoyed themselves a quarter so much, before the entertainment was brightened with the excitement he furnished. And now, when they were all in lively anticipation of the two villains being taken, and when the bellows seemed to roar for the fugitives, the fire to flare for them, the smoke to hurry away in pursuit of them, Joe to hammer and clink for them, and all the murky shadows on the wall to shake at them in menace as the blaze rose and sank, and the red-hot sparks dropped and died, the pale afternoon outside almost seemed in my pitying young fancy to have turned pale on their account. Poor wretches! At last, Joe's job was done, and the ringing and roaring stopped. As Joe got on his coat, he mustered courage to propose that some of us should go down with the soldiers and see what came of the hunt. Mr. Pumblechook and Mr. Hubble declined, on the plea of a pipe and ladies' society, but Mr. Wopsle said he would go, if Joe would. Joe said he was agreeable, and would take me, if Mrs. Joe approved. We never should have got leave to go, I am sure, but for Mrs. Joe's curiosity to know all about it and how it ended. As it was, she merely stipulated, "If you bring the boy back with his head blown to bits by a musket, don't look to me to put it together again." The sergeant took a polite leave of the ladies, and parted from Mr. Pumblechook as from a comrade, though I doubt if he were quite as fully sensible of that gentleman's merits under arid conditions, as when something moist was going. His men resumed their muskets and fell in. Mr. Wopsle, Joe, and I, received strict charge to keep in the rear, and to speak no word after we reached the marshes. When we were all out in the raw air and were steadily moving towards our business, I treasonably whispered to Joe, "I hope, Joe, we shan't find them." And Joe whispered to me, "I'd give a shilling if they had cut and run, Pip." We were joined by no stragglers from the village, for the weather was cold and threatening, the way dreary, the footing bad, darkness coming on, and the people had good fires indoors and were keeping the day. A few faces hurried to glowing windows and looked after us, but none came out. We passed the fingerpost, and held straight on to the churchyard. There we were stopped a few minutes by a signal from the sergeant's hand, while two or three of his men dispersed themselves among the graves, and also examined the porch. They came in again without finding anything, and then we struck out on the open marshes, through the gate at the side of the churchyard. A bitter sleet came rattling against us here on the east wind, and Joe took me on his back. Now that we were out upon the dismal wilderness where they little thought I had been within 8 or 9 hours and had seen both men hiding, I considered for the first time, with great dread, if we should come upon them, would my particular convict suppose that it was I who had brought the soldiers there? He had asked me if I was a deceiving imp, and he had said I should be a fierce young hound if I joined the hunt against him. Would he believe that I was both imp and hound in treacherous earnest, and had betrayed him? It was of no use asking myself this question now. There I was, on Joe's back, and there was Joe beneath me, charging at the ditches like a hunter, and stimulating Mr. Wopsle not to tumble on his Roman nose, and to keep up with us. The soldiers were in front of us, extending into a pretty wide line with an interval between man and man. We were taking the course I had begun with, and from which I had diverged in the mist. Either the mist was not out again yet, or the wind had dispelled it. Under the low red glare of sunset, the beacon, and the gibbet, and the mound of the battery, and the opposite shore of the river, were plain, though all of a watery lead color. With my heart thumping like a blacksmith at Joe's broad shoulder, I looked all about for any sign of the convicts. I could see none, I could hear none. Mr. Wopsle had greatly alarmed me more than once, by his blowing and hard breathing, but I knew the sounds by this time, and could dissociate them from the object of pursuit. I got a dreadful start, when I thought I heard the file still going, but it was only a sheep bell. The sheep stopped in their eating and looked timidly at us, and the cattle, their heads turned from the wind and sleet, stared angrily as if they held us responsible for both annoyances, but, except these things, and the shudder of the dying day in every blade of grass, there was no break in the bleak stillness of the marshes. The soldiers were moving on in the direction of the old battery, and we were moving on a little way behind them, when, all of a sudden, we all stopped. For there had reached us on the wings of the wind and rain, a long shout. It was repeated. It was at a distance towards the east, but it was long and loud. Nay, there seemed to be two or more shouts raised together, if one might judge from a confusion in the sound. To this effect the sergeant and the nearest men were speaking under their breath, when Joe and I came up. After another moment's listening, Joe, who was a good judge, agreed, and Mr. Wopsle, who was a bad judge, agreed. The sergeant, a decisive man, ordered that the sound should not be answered, but that the course should be changed, and that his men should make towards it at the double. So we slanted to the right, where the east was, and Joe pounded away so wonderfully, that I had to hold on tight to keep my seat. It was a run indeed now, and what Joe called, in the only two words he spoke all the time, a winder. Down banks and up banks, and over gates, and splashing into dikes, and breaking among coarse rushes, no man cared where he went. As we came nearer to the shouting, it became more and more apparent that it was made by more than one voice. Sometimes, it seemed to stop altogether, and then the soldiers stopped. When it broke out again, the soldiers made for it at a greater rate than ever, and we after them. After a while, we had so run it down, that we could hear one voice calling murder. And another voice, convicts. Runaways. Guard. This way for the runaway convicts. Then both voices would seem to be stifled in a struggle, and then would break out again. And when it had come to this, the soldiers ran like deer, and Joe too. The sergeant ran in first, when we had run the noise quite down, and two of his men ran in close upon him. Their pieces were cocked and leveled when we all ran in. "Here are both men," panted the sergeant, struggling at the bottom of a ditch. Surrender, you two. And confound you for two wild beasts. Come asunder. Water was splashing, and mud was flying, and oaths were being sworn, and blows were being struck, when some more men went down into the ditch to help the sergeant, and dragged out, separately, my convict and the other one. Both were bleeding and panting and execrating and struggling, but of course I knew them both directly.
Mind, said my convict, wiping blood from his face with his ragged sleeves, and shaking torn hair from his fingers, I took him. I give him up to you. Mind that.
It's not much to be particular about, said the sergeant, it'll do small good, my man, being in the same plight yourself. Handcuffs there.
I don't expect it to do me any good. I don't want it to do me more good than it does now, said my convict, with a greedy laugh. I took him. He knows it. That's enough for me.
The other convict was livid to look at, and, in addition to the old bruised left side of his face, seemed to be bruised and torn all over. He could not so much as get his breath to speak, until they were both separately handcuffed, but leaned upon a soldier to keep himself from falling.
Take notice, guard, he tried to murder me, were his first words.
Tried to murder him? Said my convict, disdainfully. Try, and not do it. I took him, and give him up, that's what I done. I not only prevented him getting off the marshes, but I dragged him here, dragged him this far on his way back. He's a gentleman, if you please, this villain. Now, the hulks has got its gentleman again, through me. Murder him? Worth my while, too, to murder him, when I could do worse and drag him back.
The other one still gasped, he tried to murder me. There bear witness.
Looky here, said my convict to the sergeant. Single-handed I got clear of the prison ship, I made a dash and I done it. I could hog out clear of these death-cold flats likewise. Look at my leg, you won't find much iron on it if I hadn't made the discovery that he was here. Let him go free? Let him profit by the means as I found out? Let him make a tool of me afresh and again? Once more? No, no, no. If I had died at the bottom there, and he made an emphatic swing at the ditch with his manacled hands, I'd have held to him with that grip, that you should have been safe to find him in my hold. The other fugitive, who was evidently in extreme horror of his companion, repeated, he tried to murder me. I should have been a dead man if you had not come up.
He lies, said my convict, with fierce energy. He's a liar born, and he'll die a liar. Look at his face, ain't it written there? Let him turn those eyes of his on me. I defy him to do it.
The other, with an effort at a scornful smile, which could not, however, collect the nervous working of his mouth into any set expression, looked at the soldiers, and looked about at the marshes and at the sky, but certainly did not look at the speaker.
Do you see him? Pursued my convict. Do you see what a villain he is? Do you see those groveling and wandering eyes? That's how he looked when we were tried together. He never looked at me.
The other, always working and working his dry lips and turning his eyes restlessly about him far and near, did at last turn them for a moment on the speaker, with the words, you are not much to look at, and with a half-taunting glance at the bound hands. At that point, my convict became so frantically exasperated, that he would have rushed upon him but for the interposition of the soldiers. Didn't I tell you, said the other convict then, that he would murder me, if he could? And anyone could see that he shook with fear, and that there broke out upon his lips curious white flakes, like thin snow.
Enough of this parley, said the sergeant. Light those torches.
As one of the soldiers, who carried a basket in lieu of a gun, went down on his knee to open it, my convict looked round him for the first time, and saw me. I had alighted from Joe's back on the brink of the ditch when we came up, and had not moved since. I looked at him eagerly when he looked at me, and slightly moved my hands and shook my head. I had been waiting for him to see me that I might try to assure him of my innocence. It was not at all expressed to me that he even comprehended my intention, for he gave me a look that I did not understand, and it all passed in a moment. But if he had looked at me for an hour or for a day, I could not have remembered his face ever afterwards, as having been more attentive. The soldier with the basket soon got a light, and lighted three or four torches, and took one himself and distributed the others. It had been almost dark before, but now it seemed quite dark, and soon afterwards very dark. Before we departed from that spot, four soldiers standing in a ring, fired twice into the air. Presently we saw other torches kindled at some distance behind us, and others on the marshes on the opposite bank of the river.
All right, said the sergeant. March. We had not gone far when three cannon were fired ahead of us with a sound that seemed to burst something inside my ear.
You are expected on board, said the sergeant to my convict, they know you are coming. Don't straggle, my man. close up here. The two were kept apart, and each walked surrounded by a separate guard. I had hold of Joe's hand now, and Joe carried one of the torches. Mr. Wopsle had been for going back, but Joe was resolved to see it out, so we went on with the party. There was a reasonably good path now, mostly on the edge of the river, with a divergence here and there where a dike came, with a miniature windmill on it and a muddy sluice gate. When I looked round, I could see the other lights coming in after us. The torches we carried dropped great blotches of fire upon the track, and I could see those, too, lying smoking and flaring. I could see nothing else but black darkness. Our lights warmed the air about us with their pitchy blaze, and the two prisoners seemed rather to like that, as they limped along in the midst of the muskets. We could not go fast, because of their lameness, and they were so spent, that two or three times we had to halt while they rested. After an hour or so of this traveling, we came to a rough wooden hut and a landing place. There was a guard in the hut, and they challenged, and the sergeant answered. Then, we went into the hut, where there was a smell of tobacco and whitewash, and a bright fire, and a lamp, and a stand of muskets, and a drum, and a low wooden bedstead, like an overgrown mangle without the machinery, capable of holding about a dozen soldiers all at once. Three or four soldiers who lay upon it in their greatcoats were not much interested in us, but just lifted their heads and took a sleepy stare, and then lay down again. The sergeant made some kind of report, and some entry in a book, and then the convict whom I call the other convict was drafted off with his guard, to go on board first. My convict never looked at me, except that once. While we stood in the hut, he stood before the fire looking thoughtfully at it, or putting up his feet by turns upon the hob, and looking thoughtfully at them as if he pitied them for their recent adventures. Suddenly, he turned to the sergeant, and remarked, "Dash. I wish to say something respecting this escape. It may prevent some persons laying under suspicion alonger me." "You can say what you like," returned the sergeant, standing coolly looking at him with his arms folded, "but you have no call to say it here. You'll have opportunity enough to say about it, and hear about it, before it's done with, you know." "I know, but this is another pint, a separate matter. A man can't starve, at least I can't. I took some wittles, up at the village over yonder, where the church stands amost out on the marshes." "You mean stole," said the sergeant. "And I'll tell you where from. From the blacksmith's." "Helloa," said the sergeant, staring at Joe. "Helloa, Pip," said Joe, staring at me. "It was some broken wittles, that's what it was, and a dram of liquor, and a pie." "Have you happened to miss such an article as a pie, blacksmith?" asked the sergeant, confidentially. "My wife did, at the very moment when you came in. Don't you know, Pip?" "So," said my convict, turning his eyes on Joe in a moody manner, and without the least glance at me, "so you're the blacksmith, are you? Then I'm sorry to say, I've eat your pie." "God knows you're welcome to it, so far as it was ever mine," returned Joe, with a saving remembrance of Mrs. Joe. "We don't know what you have done, but we wouldn't have you starve to death for it, poor miserable fellow creature. Would us, Pip?" The something that I had noticed before, clicked in the man's throat again, and he turned his back. The boat had returned, and his guard were ready, so we followed him to the landing place made of rough stakes and stones, and saw him put into the boat, which was rowed by a crew of convicts like himself. No one seemed surprised to see him, or interested in seeing him, or glad to see him, or sorry to see him, or spoke a word, except that somebody in the boat growled as if to dogs, "Give way, you," which was the signal for the dip of the oars. By the light of the torches, we saw the black hulk lying out a little way from the mud of the shore, like a wicked Noah's Ark. Cribbed and barred and moored by massive rusty chains, the prison ship seemed in my young eyes to be ironed like the prisoners. We saw the boat go alongside, and we saw him taken up the side and disappear. Then, the ends of the torches were flung hissing into the water, and went out, as if it were all over with him. Chapter 6. My state of mind regarding the pilfering from which I had been so unexpectedly exonerated did not impel me to frank disclosure, but I hope it had some dregs of good at the bottom of it. I do not recall that I felt any tenderness of conscience in reference to Mrs. Joe, when the fear of being found out was lifted off me. But I loved Joe, perhaps for no better reason in those early days than because the dear fellow let me love him, and, as to him, my inner self was not so easily composed. It was much upon my mind, particularly when I first saw him looking about for his file, that I ought to tell Joe the whole truth. Yet I did not, and for the reason that I mistrusted that if I did, he would think me worse than I was. The fear of losing Joe's confidence, and of thenceforth sitting in the chimney corner at night staring drearily at my forever lost companion and friend, tied up my tongue. I morbidly represented to myself that if Joe knew it, I never afterwards could see him at the fireside feeling his fair whisker, without thinking that he was meditating on it. That, if Joe knew it, I never afterwards could see him glance, however casually, at yesterday's meat or pudding when it came on today's table, without thinking that he was debating whether I had been in the pantry. That, if Joe knew it, and at any subsequent period of our joint domestic life remarked that his beer was flat or thick, the conviction that he suspected tar in it, would bring a rush of blood to my face. In a word, I was too cowardly to do what I knew to be right, as I had been too cowardly to avoid doing what I knew to be wrong. I had had no intercourse with the world at that time, and I imitated none of its many inhabitants who act in this manner. Quite an untaught genius, I made the discovery of the line of action for myself. As I was sleepy before we were far away from the prison ship, Joe took me on his back again and carried me home. He must have had a tiresome journey of it, for Mr. Wopsle, being knocked up, was in such a very bad temper that if the church had been thrown open, he would probably have excommunicated the whole expedition, beginning with Joe and myself. In his lay capacity, he persisted in sitting down in the damp to such an insane extent, that when his coat was taken off to be dried at the kitchen fire, the circumstantial evidence on his trousers would have hanged him, if it had been a capital offense. By that time, I was staggering on the kitchen floor like a little drunkard, through having been newly set upon my feet, and through having been fast asleep, and through waking in the heat and lights and noise of tongues. As I came to myself, with the aid of a heavy thump between the shoulders, and the restorative exclamation, "Yah! Was there ever such a boy as this?" from my sister, I found Joe telling them about the convict's confession, and all the visitors suggesting different ways by which he had got into the pantry. Mr. Pumblechook made out, after carefully surveying the premises, that he had first got upon the roof of the forge, and had then got upon the roof of the house, and had then let himself down the kitchen chimney by a rope made of his bedding cut into strips, and as Mr. Pumblechook was very positive and drove his own chaise cart over everybody, it was agreed that it must be so. Mr. Wopsle, indeed, wildly cried out, "No!" with the feeble malice of a tired man, but, as he had no theory, and no coat on, he was unanimously set at naught, not to mention his smoking hard behind, as he stood with his back to the kitchen fire to draw the damp out, which was not calculated to inspire confidence. This was all I heard that night before my sister clutched me, as a slumberous offense to the company's eyesight, and assisted me up to bed with such a strong hand that I seemed to have 50 boots on, and to be dangling them all against the edges of the stairs. My state of mind, as I have described it, began before I was up in the morning, and lasted long after the subject had died out, and had ceased to be mentioned saving on exceptional occasions. Chapter 7. At the time when I stood in the churchyard reading the family tombstones, I had just enough learning to be able to spell them out. My construction even of their simple meaning was not very correct, for I read "wife" of the above as a complimentary reference to my father's exaltation to a better world, and if any one of my deceased relations had been referred to as "below," I have no doubt I should have formed the worst opinions of that member of the family. Neither were my notions of the theological positions to which my catechism bound me, at all accurate, for, I have a lively remembrance that I supposed my declaration that I was to walk in the same all the days of my life, laid me under an obligation always to go through the village from our house in one particular direction, and never to vary it by turning down by the wheelwright's or up by the mill. When I was old enough, I was to be apprenticed to Joe, and until I could assume that dignity I was not to be what Mrs. Joe called pompied, or, as I render it, pampered. Therefore, I was not only odd boy about the forge, but if any neighbor happened to want an extra boy to frighten birds, or pick up stones, or do any such job, I was favored with the employment. In order, however, that our superior position might not be compromised thereby, a money box was kept on the kitchen mantelshelf, into which it was publicly made known that all my earnings were dropped. I have an impression that they were to be contributed eventually towards the liquidation of the national debt, but I know I had no hope of any personal participation in the treasure. Mr. Wopsle's great aunt kept an evening school in the village, that is to say, she was a ridiculous old woman of limited means and unlimited infirmity, who used to go to sleep from 6 to 7 every evening, in the society of youth who paid 2 pence per week each, for the improving opportunity of seeing her do it. She rented a small cottage, and Mr. Wopsle had the room upstairs, where we students used to overhear him reading aloud in a most dignified and terrific manner, and occasionally bumping on the ceiling. There was a fiction that Mr. Wopsle examined the scholars once a quarter. What he did on those occasions was to turn up his cuffs, stick up his hair, and give us Mark Antony's oration over the body of Caesar. This was always followed by Collins's Ode on the Passions, wherein I particularly venerated Mr. Wopsle as revenge throwing his bloodstained sword and thunder down, and taking the war-denouncing trumpet with a withering look. It was not with me then, as it was in later life, when I fell into the society of the passions, and compared them with Collins and Wopsle, rather to the disadvantage of both gentlemen. Mr. Wopsle's great aunt, besides keeping this educational institution, kept in the same room a little general shop. She had no idea what stock she had, or what the price of anything in it was, but there was a little greasy memorandum book kept in a drawer, which served as a catalogue of prices, and by this oracle Biddy arranged all the shop transactions. Biddy was Mr. Wopsle's great aunt's granddaughter. I confess myself quite unequal to the working out of the problem, what relation she was to Mr. Wopsle. She was an orphan like myself, like me, too, had been brought up by hand. She was most noticeable, I thought, in respect of her extremities, for, her hair always wanted brushing, her hands always wanted washing, and her shoes always wanted mending and pulling up at heel. This description must be received with a weekday limitation. On Sundays, she went to church elaborated. Much of my unassisted self, and more by the help of Biddy than of Mr. Wopsle's great aunt, I struggled through the alphabet as if it had been a bramble bush, getting considerably worried and scratched by every letter. After that I fell among those thieves, the nine figures, who seemed every evening to do something new to disguise themselves and baffle recognition. But, at last I began, in a purblind groping way, to read, write, and cipher, on the very smallest scale. One night I was sitting in the chimney corner with my slate, expending great efforts on the production of a letter to Joe. I think it must have been a full year after our hunt upon the marshes, for it was a long time after, and it was winter and a hard frost. With an alphabet on the hearth at my feet for reference, I contrived in an hour or two to print and smear this epistle, dash. Me dear Joe, I hope you are quite well. I hope I shall soon be habel for to teach you Joe, and then we sure all be so glad, and when I am printed to you Joe what larks and blevy me infx and pip. There was no indispensable necessity for my communicating with Joe by letter, inasmuch as he sat beside me and we were alone. But I delivered this written communication, slate and all, with my own hand, and Joe received it as a miracle of erudition. I say, Pip, old chap! Cried Joe, opening his blue eyes wide, what a scholar you are! Ain't you? I should like to be, said I, glancing at the slate as he held it, with a misgiving that the writing was rather hilly. Why, here's a J, said Joe, and a O equal to anything. Here's a J and O, Pip, and a J O, Joe. I had never heard Joe read aloud to any greater extent than this monosyllable, and I had observed at church last Sunday, when I accidentally held our prayer book upside down, that it seemed to suit his convenience quite as well as if it had been all right. Wishing to embrace the present occasion of finding out whether in teaching Joe, I should have to begin quite at the beginning, I said, ah. But read the rest, Joe. The rest, eh, Pip? Said Joe, looking at it with a slow, searching eye. 1, 2, 3. Why, here's 3 J's, and 3 O's, and 3 J O, Joe's in it, Pip. I leaned over Joe, and, with the aid of my forefinger, read him the whole letter. Astonishing! Said Joe, when I had finished. You're a scholar. How do you spell Gargory, Joe? I asked him, with a modest patronage. I don't spell it at all, said Joe. But supposing you did? It can't be supposed, said Joe. Though I'm uncommon fond of reading, too. Are you, Joe? Uncommon. Give me, said Joe, a good book, or a good newspaper, and sit me down afore a good fire, and I ask no better. Lord! He continued, after rubbing his knees a little, when you do come to a J and O, and says you, here, at last, is a J O, Joe, how interesting reading is! I derived from this, that Joe's education, like steam, was yet in its infancy. Pursuing the subject, I inquired, dash. Didn't you ever go to school, Joe, when you were as little as me? No, Pip. Why didn't you ever go to school, Joe, when you were as little as me? Well, Pip, said Joe, taking up the poker, and settling himself to his usual occupation when he was thoughtful, of slowly raking the fire between the lower bars, I'll tell you. My father, Pip, he were given to drink, and when he were overtook with drink, he hammered away at my mother, most unmerciful. It were most the only hammering he did, indeed, excepting at myself. And he hammered at me with a wigger only to be equaled by the wigger with which he didn't hammer at his Ann Will. You're listening and understanding, Pip? Yes, Joe. Consequence, my mother and me we ran away from my father several times, and then my mother she'd go out to work, and she'd say, Joe, she'd say, now, "Please God, you shall have some schooling, child," and she'd put me to school. But my father were that good in his heart that he couldn't abear to be without us. So, he'd come with a most tremendous crowd and make such a row at the doors of the houses where we was, that they used to be obligated to have no more to do with us and to give us up to him. And then he took us home and hammered us. "Which, you see, Pip," said Joe, pausing in his meditative raking of the fire, and looking at me, "were a drawback on my learning."
"Certainly, poor Joe."
"Though mind you, Pip," said Joe, with a judicial touch or two of the poker on the top bar, rendering unto all their due, and maintaining equal justice betwixt man and man, "my father were that good in his heart, don't you see?"
I didn't see, but I didn't say so.
"Well," Joe pursued, "somebody must keep the pot a-biling, Pip, or the pot won't bile, don't you know?"
I saw that, and said so.
Consequence, my father didn't make objections to my going to work, so I went to work at my present calling, which were his too, if he would have followed it, and I worked tolerable hard, I assure you, Pip. In time I were able to keep him, and I kept him till he went off in a purple leptic fit. And it were my intentions to have had put upon his tombstone that, whatsoever the failings on his part, remember reader he were that good in his heart." Joe recited this couplet with such manifest pride and careful perspicuity, that I asked him if he had made it himself.
"I made it," said Joe, "my own self. I made it in a moment. It was like striking out a horseshoe complete, in a single blow. I never was so much surprised in all my life, couldn't credit my own ed, to tell you the truth, hardly believed it were my own ed. As I was saying, Pip, it were my intentions to have had it cut over him, but poetry costs money, cut it how you will, small or large, and it were not done. Not to mention bearers, all the money that could be spared were wanted for my mother. She were in poor ilth, and quite broke. She weren't long of following, poor soul, and her share of peace come round at last." Joe's blue eyes turned a little watery, he rubbed first one of them, and then the other, in a most uncongenial and uncomfortable manner, with the round knob on the top of the poker.
"It were but lonesome then," said Joe, "living here alone, and I got acquainted with your sister. Now, Pip," Joe looked firmly at me as if he knew I was not going to agree with him, "your sister is a fine figure of a woman." I could not help looking at the fire, in an obvious state of doubt. Whatever family opinions, or whatever the world's opinions, on that subject may be, Pip, your sister is, Joe tapped the top bar with the poker after every word following, "a fine figure of a woman."
"I could think of nothing better to say than I am glad you think so, Joe."
"So am I," returned Joe, catching me up. "I am glad I think so, Pip. A little redness or a little matter of bone, here or there, what does it signify to me?"
I sagaciously observed, "If it didn't signify to him, to whom did it signify?"
"Certainly," assented Joe. "That's it. You're right, old chap. When I got acquainted with your sister, it were the talk how she was bringing you up by hand. Very kind of her too, all the folks said, and I said, along with all the folks. As to you," Joe pursued with a countenance expressive of seeing something very nasty indeed, "if you could have been aware how small and flabby and mean you was, dear me, you'd have formed the most contemptible opinion of yourself." Not exactly relishing this, I said, "Never mind me, Joe."
"But I did mind you, Pip," he returned with tender simplicity. "When I offered to your sister to keep company, and to be asked in church at such times as she was willing and ready to come to the forge, I said to her, 'And bring the poor little child. God bless the poor little child,' I said to your sister, 'there's room for him at the forge.'" I broke out crying and begging pardon, and hugged Joe round the neck, who dropped the poker to hug me, and to say, "Ever the best of friends, and us, Pip? Don't cry, old chap." When this little interruption was over, Joe resumed, "Dash. Well, you see, Pip, and here we are. That's about where it lights, here we are. Now, when you take me in hand in my learning, Pip, and I tell you beforehand I am awful dull, most awful dull, Mrs. Joe mustn't see too much of what we're up to. It must be done, as I may say, on the sly. And why on the sly? I'll tell you why, Pip." He had taken up the poker again, without which, I doubt if he could have proceeded in his demonstration. "Your sister is given to government."
"Given to government, Joe?" I was startled, for I had some shadowy idea, and I am afraid I must add, hope, that Joe had divorced her in a favor of the Lords of the Admiralty, or Treasury.
"Given to government," said Joe. "Which I mean ter say the government of you and myself."
"Oh." "And she ain't over partial to having scholars on the premises, Joe continued, and in particular would not be over partial to my being a scholar, for fear as I might rise. Like a sort of rebel, don't you see? I was going to retort with an inquiry, and had got as far as why when Joe stopped me.
Stay a bit. I know what you're going to say, Pip, stay a bit. I don't deny that your sister comes the muggle over us, now and again. I don't deny that she do throw us back falls, and that she do drop down upon us heavy. At such times as when your sister is on the rampage, Pip, Joe sank his voice to a whisper and glanced at the door, candor compels fur to admit that she is a buster.
Joe pronounced this word, as if it began with at least 12 capital B's.
Why don't I rise? That were your observation when I broke it off, Pip?
Yes, Joe.
Well, said Joe, passing the poker into his left hand, that he might feel his whisker, and I had no hope of him whenever he took to that placid occupation, your sister's a mastermind.
A mastermind.
What's that? I asked, in some hope of bringing him to a stand. But Joe was readier with his definition than I had expected, and completely stopped me by arguing circularly, and answering with a fixed look, her.
And I ain't a mastermind, Joe resumed, when he had unfixed his look, and got back to his whisker. And last of all, Pip, and this I want to say very serious to you, old chap, I see so much in my poor mother, of a woman drudging and slaving and breaking her honest heart and never getting no peace in her mortal days, that I'm dead afeard of going wrong in the way of not doing what's right by a woman, and I'd fur rather of the two go wrong the t'other way, and be a little ill-convenienced myself. I wish it was only me that got put out, Pip, I wish there weren't no tickler for you, old chap, I wish I could take it all on myself, but this is the up and down and straight on it, Pip, and I hope you'll overlook shortcomings.
Young as I was, I believe that I dated a new admiration of Joe from that night. We were equals afterwards, as we had been before, but, afterwards at quiet times when I sat looking at Joe and thinking about him, I had a new sensation of feeling conscious that I was looking up to Joe in my heart.
However, said Joe, rising to replenish the fire, here's the Dutch clock a-working himself up to being equal to strike 8 of 'em, and she's not come home yet. I hope Uncle Pumblechook's mare may have set a forefoot on a piece of ice, and gone down.
Mrs. Joe made occasional trips with Uncle Pumblechook on market days, to assist him in buying such household stuffs and goods as required a woman's judgment, Uncle Pumblechook being a bachelor and reposing no confidences in his domestic servant. This was market day, and Mrs. Joe was out on one of these expeditions. Joe made the fire and swept the hearth, and then we went to the door to listen for the chaise cart. It was a dry cold night, and the wind blew keenly, and the frost was white and hard. A man would die tonight of lying out on the marshes, I thought. And then I looked at the stars, and considered how awful it would be for a man to turn his face up to them as he froze to death, and see no help or pity in all the glittering multitude.
Here comes the mare, said Joe, ringing like a peal of bells.
The sound of her iron shoes upon the hard road was quite musical, as she came along at a much brisker trot than usual. We got a chair out, ready for Mrs. Joe's alighting, and stirred up the fire that they might see a bright window, and took a final survey of the kitchen that nothing might be out of its place. When we had completed these preparations, they drove up, wrapped to the eyes. Mrs. Joe was soon landed, and Uncle Pumblechook was soon down too, covering the mare with a cloth, and we were soon all in the kitchen, carrying so much cold air in with us that it seemed to drive all the heat out of the fire.
Now, said Mrs. Joe, unwrapping herself with haste and excitement, and throwing her bonnet back on her shoulders where it hung by the strings, if this boy ain't grateful this night, he never will be.
I looked as grateful as any boy possibly could, who was wholly uninformed why he ought to assume that expression.
It's only to be hoped, said my sister, that he won't be pompied. But I have my fears.
She ain't in that line, Mum, said Mr. Pumblechook. She knows better.
She? I looked at Joe, making the motion with my lips and eyebrows.
She?
Joe looked at me, making the motion with his lips and eyebrows.
She?
My sister catching him in the act, he drew the back of his hand across his nose with his usual conciliatory air on such occasions, and looked at her.
Well? Said my sister, in her snappish way. What are you staring at? Is the house afire?
Which some individual, Joe politely hinted, mentioned she.
And she is a she, I suppose? Said my sister.
Unless you call Miss Havisham a he. And I doubt if even you'll go so far as that.
Miss Havisham, uptown? Said Joe.
Is there any Miss Havisham downtown? Returned my sister.
She wants this boy to go and play there. And of course he's going.
And he had better play there, said my sister, shaking her head at me as an encouragement to be extremely light and sportive,
or I'll work him. I had heard of Miss Havisham uptown. Everybody for miles round had heard of Miss Havisham uptown, as an immensely rich and grim lady who lived in a large and dismal house barricaded against robbers, and who led a life of seclusion.
"Well, to be sure," said Joe, astounded. "I wonder how she come to know Pip."
"Noodle," cried my sister, who said she knew him.
Which some individual, Joe again politely hinted, mentioned that she wanted him to go and play there.
And couldn't she ask Uncle Pumblechook if he knew of a boy to go and play there? Isn't it just barely possible that Uncle Pumblechook may be a tenant of hers, and that he may sometimes, we won't say quarterly or half-yearly, for that would be requiring too much of you, but sometimes go there to pay his rent? And couldn't she then ask Uncle Pumblechook if he knew of a boy to go and play there? And couldn't Uncle Pumblechook, being always considerate and thoughtful for us though you may not think it, Joseph, in a tone of the deepest reproach, as if he were the most callous of nephews, then mention this boy, standing prancing here, which I solemnly declare I was not doing, that I have forever been a willing slave to?"
"Good again," cried Uncle Pumblechook.
"Well put. Prettily pointed. Good indeed. Now Joseph, you know the case."
"No, Joseph," said my sister, still in a reproachful manner, while Joe apologetically drew the back of his hand across and across his nose, "you do not yet, though you may not think it, know the case. You may consider that you do, but you do not, Joseph. For you do not know that Uncle Pumblechook, being sensible that for anything we can tell, this boy's fortune may be made by his going to Miss Havisham's, has offered to take him into town tonight in his own chaise cart, and to keep him tonight, and to take him with his own hands to Miss Havisham's tomorrow morning. And Laura mussy me," cried my sister, casting off her bonnet in sudden desperation, "here I stand talking to mere mooncalfs, with Uncle Pumblechook waiting, and the mare catching cold at the door, and the boy grimed with crock and dirt from the hair of his head to the sole of his foot." With that, she pounced upon me, like an eagle on a lamb, and my face was squeezed into wooden bowls and sinks, and my head was put under taps of water butts, and I was soaped, and kneaded, and toweled, and thumped, and harrowed, and rasped, until I really was quite beside myself. I may here remark that I suppose myself to be better acquainted than any living authority with the ridgy effect of a wedding ring, passing unsympathetically over the human countenance. When my ablutions were completed, I was put into clean linen of the stiffest character, like a young penitent into sackcloth, and was trussed up in my tightest and fearfulest suit. I was then delivered over to Mr. Pumblechook, who formally received me as if he were the sheriff, and who led off upon me the speech that I knew he had been dying to make all along: "Boy, be forever grateful to all friends, but especially unto them which brought you up by hand. Goodbye, Joe. God bless you, Pip, old chap." I had never parted from him before, and what with my feelings and what with soapsuds, I could at first see no stars from the chaise cart. But they twinkled out one by one, without throwing any light on the questions why on earth I was going to play at Miss Havisham's, and what on earth I was expected to play at. Chapter 8. Mr. Pumblechook's premises in the high street of the market town were of a peppercorny and farinaceous character, as the premises of a corn chandler and seedsman should be. It appeared to me that he must be a very happy man indeed, to have so many little drawers in his shop, and I wondered when I peeped into one or two on the lower tiers, and saw the tied-up brown paper packets inside, whether the flower seeds and bulbs ever wanted of a fine day to break out of those jails, and bloom. It was in the early morning after my arrival that I entertained this speculation. On the previous night, I had been sent straight to bed in an attic with a sloping roof, which was so low in the corner where the bedstead was, that I calculated the tiles as being within a foot of my eyebrows. In the same early morning, I discovered a singular affinity between seeds and corduroys. Mr. Pumblechook wore corduroys, and so did a shopman, and somehow, there was a general air and flavor about the corduroys, so much in the nature of seeds, and a general air and flavor about the seeds, so much in the nature of corduroys, that I hardly knew which was which. The same opportunity served me for noticing that Mr. Pumblechook appeared to conduct his business by looking across the street at the saddler, who appeared to transact his business by keeping his eye on the coachmaker, who appeared to get on in life by putting his hands in his pockets and contemplating the baker, who in his turn folded his arms and stared at the grocer, who stood at his door and yawned at the chemist. The watchmaker, always poring over a little desk with a magnifying glass at his eye, and always inspected by a group of smock frocks poring over him through the glass of his shop window, seemed to be about the only person in the high street whose trade engaged his attention. Mr. Pumblechook and I breakfasted at 8 o'clock in the parlor behind the shop, while the shopman took his mug of tea and hunch of bread and butter on a sack of peas in the front premises. I considered Mr. Pumblechook wretched company.
besides being possessed by my sister's idea that a mortifying and penitential character ought to be imparted to my diet, besides giving me as much crumb as possible in combination with as little butter, and putting such a quantity of warm water into my milk that it would have been more candid to have left the milk out altogether, his conversation consisted of nothing but arithmetic. On my politely bidding him good morning, he said, pompously, 7 times 9, boy? And how should I be able to answer, dodged in that way, in a strange place, on an empty stomach? I was hungry, but before I had swallowed a morsel, he began a running sum that lasted all through the breakfast. 7? And 4? And 8? And 6? And 2? And 10? And so on. And after each figure was disposed of, it was as much as I could do to get a bite or a sup, before the next came, while he sat at his ease guessing nothing, and eating bacon and hot roll, in, if I may be allowed the expression, a gorging and gourmandizing manner. For such reasons, I was very glad when 10 o'clock came and we started for Miss Havisham's, though I was not at all at my ease regarding the manner in which I should acquit myself under that lady's roof. Within a quarter of an hour we came to Miss Havisham's house, which was of old brick, and dismal, and had a great many iron bars to it. Some of the windows had been walled up, of those that remained, all the lower were rustily barred. There was a courtyard in front, and that was barred, so we had to wait, after ringing the bell, until someone should come to open it. While we waited at the gate, I peeped in. Even then Mr. Pumblechook said, "And 14?" But I pretended not to hear him, and saw that at the side of the house there was a large brewery. No brewing was going on in it, and none seemed to have gone on for a long, long time. A window was raised, and a clear voice demanded what name? To which my conductor replied, "Pumblechook." The voice returned, "Quite right," and the window was shut again, and a young lady came across the courtyard, with keys in her hand. "This," said Mr. Pumblechook, "is Pip." "This is Pip, is it?" returned the young lady, who was very pretty and seemed very proud. "Come in, Pip." Mr. Pumblechook was coming in also, when she stopped him with the gate. "Oh," she said. "Did you wish to see Miss Havisham?" "If Miss Havisham wished to see me," returned Mr. Pumblechook, discomfited. "Ah," said the girl, "but you see she don't." She said it so finally, and in such an undiscussable way, that Mr. Pumblechook, though in a condition of ruffled dignity, could not protest. But he eyed me severely, as if I had done anything to him, and departed with the words reproachfully delivered, "Boy, let your behavior here be a credit unto them which brought you up by hand." I was not free from apprehension that he would come back to propound through the gate, and 16? But he didn't. My young conductress locked the gate, and we went across the courtyard. It was paved and clean, but grass was growing in every crevice. The brewery buildings had a little lane of communication with it, and the wooden gates of that lane stood open, and all the brewery beyond stood open, away to the high enclosing wall, and all was empty and disused. The cold wind seemed to blow colder there than outside the gate, and it made a shrill noise in howling in and out at the open sides of the brewery, like the noise of wind in the rigging of a ship at sea. She saw me looking at it, and she said, "You could drink without hurt all the strong beer that's brewed there now, boy." "I should think I could, miss," said I, in a shy way. "Better not try to brew beer there now, or it would turn out sour, boy, don't you think so?" "It looks like it, miss." "Not that anybody means to try," she added, "for that's all done with, and the place will stand as idle as it is till it falls. As to strong beer, there's enough of it in the cellars already, to drown the manor house." "Is that the name of this house, miss?"
"One of its names, boy."
"It has more than one, then, miss?"
"One more. Its other name was Satis, which is Greek, or Latin, or Hebrew, or all three or all one to me for enough."
"Enough house," said I, "that's a curious name, miss."
"Yes," she replied, "but it meant more than it said. It meant, when it was given, that whoever had this house could want nothing else. They must have been easily satisfied in those days, I should think. But don't loiter, boy." Though she called me boy so often, and with a carelessness that was far from complimentary, she was of about my own age. She seemed much older than I, of course, being a girl, and beautiful and self-possessed, and she was as scornful of me as if she had been 21, and a queen. We went into the house by a side door. The great front entrance had 2 chains across it outside, and the first thing I noticed was, that the passages were all dark, and that she had left a candle burning there. She took it up, and we went through more passages and up a staircase, and still it was all dark, and only the candle lighted us. At last we came to the door of a room, and she said, "Go in."
I answered, more in shyness than politeness, after you, miss. To this she returned, don't be ridiculous, boy, I am not going in. And scornfully walked away, and what was worse took the candle with her. This was very uncomfortable, and I was half afraid. However, the only thing to be done being to knock at the door, I knocked, and was told from within to enter. I entered, therefore, and found myself in a pretty large room, well lighted with wax candles. No glimpse of daylight was to be seen in it. It was a dressing room, as I supposed from the furniture, though much of it was of forms and uses then quite unknown to me. But prominent in it was a draped table with a gilded looking glass, and that I made out at first sight to be a fine lady's dressing table. Whether I should have made out this object so soon if there had been no fine lady sitting at it, I cannot say. In an armchair, with an elbow resting on the table and her head leaning on that hand, sat the strangest lady I have ever seen, or shall ever see. She was dressed in rich materials, satins, and lace, and silks, all of white. Her shoes were white. And she had a long white veil dependent from her hair, and she had bridal flowers in her hair, but her hair was white. Some bright jewels sparkled on her neck and on her hands, and some other jewels lay sparkling on the table. Dresses, less splendid than the dress she wore, and half-packed trunks, were scattered about. She had not quite finished dressing, for she had but one shoe on, the other was on the table near her hand, her veil was but half arranged, her watch and chain were not put on, and some lace for her bosom lay with those trinkets, and with her handkerchief, and gloves, and some flowers, and a prayer book all confusedly heaped about the looking glass. It was not in the first few moments that I saw all these things, though I saw more of them in the first moments than might be supposed. But I saw that everything within my view which ought to be white, had been white long ago, and had lost its luster and was faded and yellow. I saw that the bride within the bridal dress had withered like the dress, and like the flowers, and had no brightness left but the brightness of her sunken eyes. I saw that the dress had been put upon the rounded figure of a young woman, and that the figure upon which it now hung loose had shrunk to skin and bone. Once, I had been taken to see some ghastly waxwork at the fair, representing I know not what impossible personage lying in state. Once, I had been taken to one of our old marsh churches to see a skeleton in the ashes of a rich dress that had been dug out of a vault under the church pavement. Now, waxwork and skeleton seemed to have dark eyes that moved and looked at me. I should have cried out, if I could. "Who is it?" said the lady at the table. "Pip, ma'am." "Pip?" "Mr. Pumblechook's boy, ma'am. Come to play. Come nearer, let me look at you. Come close." It was when I stood before her, avoiding her eyes, that I took note of the surrounding objects in detail, and saw that her watch had stopped at 9:20, and that a clock in the room had stopped at 9:20. "Look at me," said Miss Havisham. "You are not afraid of a woman who has never seen the sun since you were born?" I regret to state that I was not afraid of telling the enormous lie comprehended in the answer no. "Do you know what I touch here?" she said, laying her hands, one upon the other, on her left side. "Yes, ma'am. It made me think of the young man." "What do I touch?" "Your heart." "Broken." She uttered the word with an eager look, and with strong emphasis, and with a weird smile that had a kind of boast in it. Afterwards she kept her hands there for a little while, and slowly took them away as if they were heavy. "I am tired," said Miss Havisham. "I want diversion, and I have done with men and women. Play." I think it will be conceded by my most disputatious reader, that she could hardly have directed an unfortunate boy to do anything in the wide world more difficult to be done under the circumstances. "I sometimes have sick fancies," she went on, "and I have a sick fancy that I want to see some play. There, there." With an impatient movement of the fingers of her right hand, "play, play, play." For a moment, with the fear of my sister's working me before my eyes, I had a desperate idea of starting round the room in the assumed character of Mr. Pumblechook's chaise cart. But I felt myself so unequal to the performance that I gave it up, and stood looking at Miss Havisham in what I suppose she took for a dogged manner, inasmuch as she said, when we had taken a good look at each other, - "Are you sullen and obstinate?" "No, ma'am, I am very sorry for you, and very sorry I can't play just now. If you complain of me I shall get into trouble with my sister, so I would do it if I could, but it's so new here, and so strange, and so fine, and melancholy." I stopped, fearing I might say too much, or had already said it, and we took another look at each other. Before she spoke again, she turned her eyes from me, and looked at the dress she wore, and at the dressing table, and finally at herself in the looking glass. "So new to him," she muttered, "so old to me, so strange to him,
so familiar to me, so melancholy to both of us. Call Estella. As she was still looking at the reflection of herself, I thought she was still talking to herself, and kept quiet. Call Estella, she repeated, flashing a look at me. You can do that. Call Estella. At the door. To stand in the dark in a mysterious passage of an unknown house, bawling Estella to a scornful young lady neither visible nor responsive, and feeling it a dreadful liberty so to roar out her name, was almost as bad as playing to order. But she answered at last, and her light came along the dark passage like a star. Miss Havisham beckoned her to come close, and took up a jewel from the table, and tried its effect upon her fair young bosom and against her pretty brown hair. Your own, one day, my dear, and you will use it well. Let me see you play cards with this boy. With this boy? Why, he is a common laboring boy. I thought I overheard Miss Havisham answer, only it seems so unlikely. Well, you can break his heart. What do you play, boy? Asked Estella of myself, with the greatest disdain. Nothing but beggar my neighbor, miss. Beggar him, said Miss Havisham to Estella. So we sat down to cards. It was then I began to understand that everything in the room had stopped, like the watch and the clock, a long time ago. I noticed that Miss Havisham put down the jewel exactly on the spot from which she had taken it up. As Estella dealt the cards, I glanced at the dressing table again, and saw that the shoe upon it, once white, now yellow, had never been worn. I glanced down at the foot from which the shoe was absent, and saw that the silk stocking on it, once white, now yellow, had been trodden ragged. Without this arrest of everything, this standing still of all the pale decayed objects, not even the withered bridal dress on the collapsed form could have looked so like grave clothes, or the long veil so like a shroud. So she sat, corpse-like, as we played at cards, the frillings and trimmings on her bridal dress, looking like earthy paper. I knew nothing then of the discoveries that are occasionally made of bodies buried in ancient times, which fall to powder in the moment of being distinctly seen, but, I have often thought since, that she must have looked as if the admission of the natural light of day would have struck her to dust. He calls the knaves jacks, this boy, said Estella with disdain, before our first game was out. And what coarse hands he has! And what thick boots! I had never thought of being ashamed of my hands before, but I began to consider them a very indifferent pair. Her contempt for me was so strong, that it became infectious, and I caught it. She won the game, and I dealt. I misdealt, as was only natural, when I knew she was lying in wait for me to do wrong, and she denounced me for a stupid, clumsy laboring boy. You say nothing of her, remarked Miss Havisham to me, as she looked on. She says many hard things of you, but you say nothing of her. What do you think of her? I don't like to say, I stammered. Tell me in my ear, said Miss Havisham, bending down. I think she is very proud, I replied, in a whisper. Anything else? I think she is very pretty. Anything else? I think she is very insulting. She was looking at me then with a look of supreme aversion. Anything else? I think I should like to go home. And never see her again, though she is so pretty. I am not sure that I shouldn't like to see her again, but I should like to go home now. You shall go soon, said Miss Havisham, aloud. Play the game out. Saving for the one weird smile at first, I should have felt almost sure that Miss Havisham's face could not smile. It had dropped into a watchful and brooding expression, most likely when all the things about her had become transfixed, and it looked as if nothing could ever lift it up again. Her chest had dropped, so that she stooped, and her voice had dropped, so that she spoke low, and with a dead lull upon her, altogether, she had the appearance of having dropped body and soul, within and without, under the weight of a crushing blow. I played the game to an end with Estella, and she beggared me. She threw the cards down on the table when she had won them all, as if she despised them for having been one of me. When shall I have you here again? Said Miss Havisham. Let me think. I was beginning to remind her that today was Wednesday, when she checked me with her former impatient movement of the fingers of her right hand. There, there. I know nothing of days of the week, I know nothing of weeks of the year. Come again after 6 days. You hear? Yes, ma'am. Estella, take him down. Let him have something to eat, and let him roam and look about him while he eats. Go, Pip. I followed the candle down, as I had followed the candle up, and she stood it in the place where we had found it. Until she opened the side entrance, I had fancied, without thinking about it, that it must necessarily be nighttime. The rush of the daylight quite confounded me, and made me feel as if I had been in the candlelight of the strange room many hours. You are to wait here, you boy,
said Estella, and disappeared and closed the door. I took the opportunity of being alone in the courtyard to look at my coarse hands and my common boots. My opinion of those accessories was not favorable. They had never troubled me before, but they troubled me now, as vulgar appendages. I determined to ask Joe why he had ever taught me to call those picture cards jacks, which ought to be called knaves. I wish Joe had been rather more genteelly brought up, and then I should have been so too. She came back, with some bread and meat and a little mug of beer. She put the mug down on the stones of the yard, and gave me the bread and meat without looking at me, as insolently as if I were a dog in disgrace. I was so humiliated, hurt, spurned, offended, angry, sorry, I cannot hit upon the right name for the smart God knows what its name was, that tears started to my eyes. The moment they sprang there, the girl looked at me with a quick delight in having been the cause of them. This gave me power to keep them back and to look at her, so, she gave a contemptuous toss but with a sense, I thought, of having made too sure that I was so wounded and left me. But when she was gone, I looked about me for a place to hide my face in, and got behind one of the gates in the brewery lane, and leaned my sleeve against the wall there, and leaned my forehead on it and cried. As I cried, I kicked the wall, and took a hard twist at my hair, so bitter were my feelings, and so sharp was the smart without a name, that needed counteraction. My sister's bringing up had made me sensitive. In the little world in which children have their existence, whosoever brings them up, there is nothing so finely perceived and so finely felt as injustice. It may be only small injustice that the child can be exposed to, but the child is small, and its world is small, and its rocking horse stands as many hands high, according to scale, as a big-boned Irish hunter. Within myself, I had sustained, from my babyhood, a perpetual conflict with injustice. I had known, from the time when I could speak, that my sister, in her capricious and violent coercion, was unjust to me. I had cherished a profound conviction that her bringing me up by hand gave her no right to bring me up by jerks. Through all my punishments, disgraces, fasts, and vigils, and other penitential performances, I had nursed this assurance, and to my communing so much with it, in a solitary and unprotected way, I in great part refer the fact that I was morally timid and very sensitive. I got rid of my injured feelings for the time by kicking them into the brewery wall, and twisting them out of my hair, and then I smoothed my face with my sleeve, and came from behind the gate. The bread and meat were acceptable, and the beer was warming and tingling, and I was soon in spirits to look about me. To be sure, it was a deserted place, down to the pigeon house in the brewery yard, which had been blown crooked on its pole by some high wind, and would have made the pigeons think themselves at sea, if there had been any pigeons there to be rocked by it. But there were no pigeons in the dovecot, no horses in the stable, no pigs in the sty, no malt in the storehouse, no smells of grains and beer in the copper or the vat. All the uses and scents of the brewery might have evaporated with its last reek of smoke. In a byyard, there was a wilderness of empty casks, which had a certain sour remembrance of better days lingering about them, but it was too sour to be accepted as a sample of the beer that was gone, and in this respect I remember those recluses as being like most others. Behind the furthest end of the brewery, was a rank garden with an old wall, not so high but that I could struggle up and hold on long enough to look over it, and see that the rank garden was the garden of the house, and that it was overgrown with tangled weeds, but that there was a track upon the green and yellow paths, as if someone sometimes walked there, and that Estella was walking away from me even then. But she seemed to be everywhere. For when I yielded to the temptation presented by the casks, and began to walk on them, I saw her walking on them at the end of the yard of casks. She had her back towards me, and held her pretty brown hair spread out in her two hands, and never looked round, and passed out of my view directly. So, in the brewery itself, by which I mean the large paved lofty place in which they used to make the beer, and where the brewing utensils still were. When I first went into it, and, rather oppressed by its gloom, stood near the door looking about me, I saw her pass among the extinguished fires, and ascend some light iron stairs, and go out by a gallery high overhead, as if she were going out into the sky. It was in this place, and at this moment, that a strange thing happened to my fancy. I thought it a strange thing then, and I thought it a stranger thing long afterwards. I turned my eyes a little dimmed by looking up at the frosty light towards a great wooden beam in a low nook of the building near me on my right hand, and I saw a figure hanging there by the neck. A figure all in yellow-white, with but one shoe to the feet, and it hung so, that I could see that the faded trimmings of the dress were like earthy paper, and that the face was Miss Havisham's, with a movement going over the whole countenance as if she were trying to call to me. In the terror of seeing the figure, and in the terror of being certain that it had not been there a moment before, I at first ran from it, and then ran towards it.
And my terror was greatest of all when I found no figure there. Nothing less than the frosty light of the cheerful sky, the sight of people passing beyond the bars of the courtyard gate, and the reviving influence of the rest of the bread and meat and beer, would have brought me round. Even with those aids, I might not have come to myself as soon as I did, but that I saw Estella approaching with the keys, to let me out. She would have some fair reason for looking down upon me, I thought, if she saw me frightened, and she would have no fair reason. She gave me a triumphant glance in passing me, as if she rejoiced that my hands were so coarse and my boots were so thick, and she opened the gate, and stood holding it. I was passing out without looking at her, when she touched me with a taunting hand. "Why don't you cry?" "Because I don't want to." "You do," said she. "You have been crying till you are half blind, and you are near crying again now." She laughed contemptuously, pushed me out, and locked the gate upon me. I went straight to Mr. Pumblechook's, and was immensely relieved to find him not at home. So, leaving word with the shopman on what day I was wanted at Miss Havisham's again, I set off on the 4-mile walk to our forge, pondering, as I went along, on all I had seen, and deeply revolving that I was a common laboring boy, that my hands were coarse, that my boots were thick, that I had fallen into a despicable habit of calling knaves jacks, that I was much more ignorant than I had considered myself last night, and generally that I was in a low-lived bad way. Chapter 9. When I reached home, my sister was very curious to know all about Miss Havisham's, and asked a number of questions. And I soon found myself getting heavily bumped from behind in the nape of the neck and the small of the back, and having my face ignominiously shoved against the kitchen wall, because I did not answer those questions at sufficient length. If a dread of not being understood be hidden in the breasts of other young people to anything like the extent to which it used to be hidden in mine, which I consider probable, as I have no particular reason to suspect myself of having been a monstrosity, it is the key to many reservations. I felt convinced that if I described Miss Havisham's as my eyes had seen it, I should not be understood. Not only that, but I felt convinced that Miss Havisham too would not be understood, and although she was perfectly incomprehensible to me, I entertained an impression that there would be something coarse and treacherous in my dragging her as she really was, to say nothing of Miss Estella, before the contemplation of Mrs. Joe. Consequently, I said as little as I could, and had my face shoved against the kitchen wall. The worst of it was that bullying old Pumblechook, preyed upon by a devouring curiosity to be informed of all I had seen and heard, came gaping over in his chaise cart at tea time, to have the details divulged to him. And the mere sight of the torment, with his fishy eyes and mouth open, his sandy hair inquisitively on end, and his waistcoat heaving with windy arithmetic, made me vicious in my reticence. "Well, boy," Uncle Pumblechook began, as soon as he was seated in the chair of honor by the fire, "how did you get on uptown?" I answered, "Pretty well, sir," and my sister shook her fist at me. "Pretty well?" Mr. Pumblechook repeated. "Pretty well is no answer. Tell us what you mean by pretty well, boy?" "Whitewash on the forehead hardens the brain into a state of obstinacy perhaps. Anyhow, with whitewash from the wall on my forehead, my obstinacy was adamantine." I reflected for some time, and then answered as if I had discovered a new idea, "I mean pretty well." My sister with an exclamation of impatience was going to fly at me. I had no shadow of defense, for Joe was busy in the forge, when Mr. Pumblechook interposed with, "No. Don't lose your temper. Leave this lad to me, ma'am, leave this lad to me." Mr. Pumblechook then turned me towards him, as if he were going to cut my hair, and said, "Dash. First, to get our thoughts in order, 43 pence? I calculated the consequences of replying £400, and finding them against me, went as near the answer as I could, which was somewhere about 8 pence off. Mr. Pumblechook then put me through my pence table from 12 pence make 1 shilling, up to 40 pence make 3 and 4 pence, and then triumphantly demanded, as if he had done for me, "Now, how much is 43 pence? To which I replied, after a long interval of reflection, "I don't know." And I was so aggravated that I almost doubt if I did know. Mr. Pumblechook worked his head like a screw to screw it out of me, and said, "Is 43 pence 7 and 6 pence 3 farthings, for instance?" "Yes," said I, and although my sister instantly boxed my ears, it was highly gratifying to me to see that the answer spoilt his joke, and brought him to a dead stop. "Boy, what like is Miss Havisham?" Mr. Pumblechook began again when he had recovered, folding his arms tight on his chest and applying the screw. "Very tall and dark," I told him. "Is she, uncle?" asked my sister. Mr. Pumblechook winked assent, from which I at once inferred that he had never seen Miss Havisham, for she was nothing of the kind. "Good.
said Mr. Pumblechook conceitedly. This is the way to have him. We are beginning to hold our own, I think, Mum?
I am sure, Uncle, returned Mrs. Joe, I wish you had him always, you know so well how to deal with him.
Now, boy, what was she a-doing of, when you went in today? Asked Mr. Pumblechook.
She was sitting, I answered, in a black velvet coach.
Mr. Pumblechook and Mrs. Joe stared at one another as they well might and both repeated, in a black velvet coach?
Yes, said I. And Mrs. Tella, that's her niece, I think handed her in cake and wine at the coach window, on a gold plate. And we all had cake and wine on gold plates. And I got up behind the coach to eat mine, because she told me to.
Was anybody else there? Asked Mr. Pumblechook.
Four dogs, said I.
Large or small?
Immense, said I. And they fought for veal cutlets out of a silver basket.
Mr. Pumblechook and Mrs. Joe stared at one another again, in utter amazement. I was perfectly frantic, a reckless witness under the torture, and would have told them anything.
Where was this coach, in the name of gracious? Asked my sister.
In Miss Havisham's room. They stared again. But there weren't any horses to it. I added this saving clause, in the moment of rejecting four richly caparisoned coursers which I had had wild thoughts of harnessing.
Can this be possible, Uncle? Asked Mrs. Joe. What can the boy mean?
I'll tell you, Mum, said Mr. Pumblechook. My opinion is, it's a sedan chair. She's flighty, you know, very flighty, quite flighty enough to pass her days in a sedan chair.
Did you ever see her in it, Uncle? Asked Mrs. Joe.
How could I, he returned, forced to the admission, when I never see her in my life. Never clapped eyes upon her.
Goodness, Uncle. And yet you have spoken to her?
Why, don't you know, said Mr. Pumblechook, testily, that when I have been there, I have been took up to the outside of her door, and the door has stood ajar, and she has spoke to me that way.
Don't say you don't know that, Mum. Howsever, the boy went there to play.
What did you play at, boy?
We played with flags, I said. I beg to observe that I think of myself with amazement, when I recall the lies I told on this occasion.
Flags. Echoed my sister.
Yes, said I. Estella waved a blue flag, and I waved a red one, and Miss Havisham waved one sprinkled all over with little gold stars, out of the coach window. And then we all waved our swords and hurrahed.
Swords. Repeated my sister. Where did you get swords from?
Out of a cupboard, said I. And I saw pistols in it, and jam, and pills. And there was no daylight in the room, but it was all lighted up with candles.
That's true, Mum, said Mr. Pumblechook, with a grave nod. That's the state of the case, for that much I've seen myself. And then they both stared at me, and I, with an obtrusive show of artlessness on my countenance, stared at them, and plaited the right leg of my trousers with my right hand. If they had asked me any more questions, I should undoubtedly have betrayed myself, for I was even then on the point of mentioning that there was a balloon in the yard, and should have hazarded the statement but for my invention being divided between that phenomenon and a beer in the brewery. They were so much occupied, however, in discussing the marvels I had already presented for their consideration, that I escaped. The subject still held them when Joe came in from his work to have a cup of tea. To whom my sister, more for the relief of her own mind than for the gratification of his, related my pretended experiences. Now, when I saw Joe open his blue eyes and roll them all round the kitchen in helpless amazement, I was overtaken by penitence, but only as regarded him, not in the least as regarded the other two. Towards Joe, and Joe only, I considered myself a young monster, while they sat debating what results would come to me from Miss Havisham's acquaintance and favor. They had no doubt that Miss Havisham would do something for me, their doubts related to the form that something would take. My sister stood out for property. Mr. Pumblechook was in favor of a handsome premium for binding the apprentice to some genteel trade, say, the corn and seed trade, for instance. Joe fell into the deepest disgrace with both, for offering the bright suggestion that I might only be presented with one of the dogs who had fought for the veal cutlets. If a fool's head can't express better opinions than that, said my sister, and you have got any work to do, you had better go and do it. So he went. After Mr. Pumblechook had driven off, and when my sister was washing up, I stole into the forge to Joe, and remained by him until he had done for the night. Then I said, before the fire goes out, Joe, I should like to tell you something.
Should you, Pip? Said Joe, drawing his shoeing stool near the forge.
Then tell us.
What is it, Pip?
Joe, said I, taking hold of his rolled-up shirt sleeve, and twisting it between my finger and thumb,
You remember all that about Miss Havisham's?
Remember? Said Joe. I believe you.
Wonderful.
It's a terrible thing, Joe, it ain't true.
What are you telling of, Pip? Cried Joe, falling back in the greatest amazement. You don't mean to say it's...
Yes I do, it's lies, Joe.
But not all of it? Why sure you don't mean to say, Pip, that there was no Blackwell Echoe?
For, I stood shaking my head.
But at least there was dogs, Pip?
Come, Pip, said Joe, persuasively, if there weren't no wheel cutlets, at least there was dogs?
No, Joe.
A dog? Said Joe.
A puppy? Come?
No, Joe, there was nothing at all of the kind.
As I fixed my eyes hopelessly on Joe, Joe contemplated me in dismay.
Pip, old chap. This won't do, old fellow.
I say. Where do you expect to go to?
It's terrible, Joe, ain't it?
Terrible? Cried Joe.
Awful.
What possessed you?
I don't know what possessed me, Joe, I replied, letting his shirt sleeve go, and sitting down in the ashes at his feet, hanging my head, but I wish you hadn't taught me to call knaves at cards jacks, and I wish my boots weren't so thick nor my hands so coarse. And then I told Joe that I felt very miserable, and that I hadn't been able to explain myself to Mrs. Joe and Pumblechook, who were so rude to me, and that there had been a beautiful young lady at Miss Havisham's who was dreadfully proud, and that she had said I was common, and that I knew I was common, and that I wished I was not common, and that the lies had come of it somehow, though I didn't know how. This was a case of metaphysics, at least as difficult for Joe to deal with as for me. But Joe took the case altogether out of the region of metaphysics, and by that means vanquished it.
There's one thing you may be sure of, Pip, said Joe, after some rumination, namely, that lies is lies. Howsoever they come, they didn't ought to come, and they come from the father of lies, and work round to the same.
Don't you tell no more of him, Pip. That ain't the way to get out of being common, old chap.
And as to being common, I don't make it out at all clear. You are uncommon in some things. You're uncommon small. Likewise you're uncommon scholar.
No, I am ignorant and backward, Joe.
Why, see what a letter you wrote last night?
Wrote in print even.
I've seen letters and from gentlefolks. That I'll swear weren't wrote in print, said Joe.
I have learnt next to nothing, Joe.
You think much of me. It's only that.
Well, Pip, said Joe, be it so or be it son t, you must be a common scholar afore you can be uncommon one, I should hope. The king upon his throne, with his crown upon his head, can't sit and write his acts of parliament in print, without having begun, when he were a unpromoted prince, with the alphabet.
Ah! Added Joe, with a shake of the head that was full of meaning, and begun at A too, and worked his way to Z. And I know what that is to do, though I can't say I've exactly done it. There was some hope in this piece of wisdom, and it rather encouraged me.
Whether common ones as to callings and earnings, pursued Joe, reflectively, mightn't be the better of continuing for to keep company with common ones, instead of going out to play with uncommon ones, which reminds me to hope that there were a flag, perhaps?
No, Joe.
I'm sorry there weren't a flag, Pip. Whether that might be or mightn't be, is a thing as can't be looked into now, without putting your sister on the rampage, and that's a thing not to be thought of as being done intentional.
Look'ye here, Pip, at what is said to you by a true friend.
Which this do you the true friend say? If you can't get to be uncommon through going straight, you'll never get to do it through going crooked. So don't tell no more on 'em, Pip, and live well and die happy.
You are not angry with me, Joe?
No, old chap. But bearing in mind that them were which I mean ter say of a stunning and outdacious sort, alluding to them which bordered on wheel cutlets and dog fighting, a sincere well-wisher would add wise, Pip, they're being dropped into your meditations, when you go upstairs to bed. That's all, old chap, and don't never do it no more.
When I got up to my little room and said my prayers, I did not forget Joe's recommendation, and yet my young mind was in that disturbed and unthankful state, that I thought long after I laid me down, how common as Tella would consider Joe, a mere blacksmith, how thick his boots, and how coarse his hands. I thought how Joe and my sister were then sitting in the kitchen, and how I had come up to bed from the kitchen, and how Miss Havisham and Estelle never sat in a kitchen, but were far above the level of such common doings. I fell asleep recalling what I used to do when I was at Miss Havisham's, as though I had been there weeks or months, instead of hours, and as though it were quite an old subject of remembrance, instead of one that had arisen only that day. That was a memorable day to me, for it made great changes in me. But it is the same with any life.
Imagine one selected day struck out of it, and think how different its course would have been. Pause you who read this, and think for a moment of the long chain of iron or gold, of thorns or flowers, that would never have bound you, but for the formation of the first link on one memorable day. Chapter 10. The felicitous idea occurred to me a morning or two later when I woke, that the best step I could take towards making myself uncommon was to get out of Biddy everything she knew. In pursuance of this luminous conception, I mentioned to Biddy when I went to Mr. Wopsle's great aunt's at night, that I had a particular reason for wishing to get on in life, and that I should feel very much obliged to her if she would impart all her learning to me. Biddy, who was the most obliging of girls, immediately said she would, and indeed began to carry out her promise within 5 minutes. The educational scheme or course established by Mr. Wopsle's great aunt may be resolved into the following synopsis. The pupils ate apples and put straws down one another's backs, until Mr. Wopsle's great aunt collected her energies, and made an indiscriminate totter at them with a birch rod. After receiving the charge with every mark of derision, the pupils formed in line and buzzingly passed a ragged book from hand to hand. The book had an alphabet in it, some figures and tables, and a little spelling, that is to say, it had had once. As soon as this volume began to circulate, Mr. Wopsle's great aunt fell into a state of coma, arising either from sleep or a rheumatic paroxysm. The pupils then entered among themselves upon a competitive examination on the subject of boots, with the view of ascertaining who could tread the hardest upon whose toes. This mental exercise lasted until Biddy made a rush at them and distributed 3 defaced Bibles, shaped as if they had been unskillfully cut off the chump end of something, more illegibly printed at the best than any curiosities of literature I have since met with, speckled all over with iron mold, and having various specimens of the insect world smashed between their leaves. This part of the course was usually lightened by several single combats between Biddy and refractory students. When the fights were over, Biddy gave out the number of a page, and then we all read aloud what we could, or what we couldn't in a frightful chorus, Biddy leading with a high, shrill, monotonous voice, and none of us having the least notion of, or reverence for, what we were reading about. When this horrible din had lasted a certain time, it mechanically awoke Mr. Wopsle's great aunt, who staggered at a boy fortuitously, and pulled his ears. This was understood to terminate the course for the evening, and we emerged into the air with shrieks of intellectual victory. It is fair to remark that there was no prohibition against any pupil's entertaining himself with a slate or even with the ink, when there was any, but that it was not easy to pursue that branch of study in the winter season, on account of the little general shop in which the classes were holden and which was also Mr. Wopsle's great aunt's sitting room and bedchamber, being but faintly illuminated through the agency of one low spirit and a dip candle and no snuffers. It appeared to me that it would take time to become uncommon, under these circumstances, nevertheless, I resolved to try it, and that very evening Biddy entered on our special agreement, by imparting some information from her little catalogue of prices, under the head of moist sugar, and lending me, to copy at home, a large old English D which she had imitated from the heading of some newspaper, and which I supposed, until she told me what it was, to be a design for a buckle. Of course there was a public house in the village, and of course Joe liked sometimes to smoke his pipe there. I had received strict orders from my sister to call for him at the Three Jolly Bargemen, that evening, on my way from school, and bring him home at my peril. To the Three Jolly Bargemen, therefore, I directed my steps. There was a bar at the Jolly Bargemen, with some alarmingly long chalk scores in it on the wall at the side of the door, which seemed to me to be never paid off. They had been there ever since I could remember, and had grown more than I had. But there was a quantity of chalk about our country, and perhaps the people neglected no opportunity of turning it to account. It being Saturday night, I found the landlord looking rather grimly at these records, but as my business was with Joe and not with him, I merely wished him good evening, and passed into the